All right, so welcome to The Bailey. I'm your host, Yassine Mishod, and today we have Walt Bismarck. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. This is an exciting... We're going to talk about, I guess, generally white nationalism and how you used to believe it and also moved away from it, but also how you're still right wing. Does that sound good?
Yeah, it sounds great.
All right. I'm excited to talk about this. We also have Tracing Woodgrains. Hello, furry friend.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi. All right. So, Walt, you came to my attention thanks to Tracing Woodgrains. I think you came to a lot of people's attention thanks to him. You had a post that said that was called "Why I'm No Longer a White Nationalist," and I want to discuss that. But I also want to set like some, I guess, common definitions. So you start, you make a distinction between hard white nationalism and soft white nationalism. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So hard white nationalism is basically the goal of having an ethno state, or a, like in layman's terms, it would just be a country that exists for the benefit of a certain racial or ethnic in-group, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean that like anyone else is excluded or anybody else gets deported. It just means that it's understood that it's part of like the constitution, it's part of the philosophical common assumptions and understandings of society that this nation is supposed to exist for some specified group. Okay. So, you know, we didn't advocate, I need to like make very clear, like nobody in the alt-right, at least like no major figures and no content creators, like nobody was really advocating any kind of violent ethnic cleansing or anything like that. Now, some people would advocate nonviolent ethnic cleansing, which was, you know, basically the sort of thing that happened after World War One, like between Turkey and Greece, where you'd have like population exchanges or maybe like a racial breakup of the country, like a partition. You know, there's a lot of talk of that kind of stuff. But hard white nationalism, you know, it typically wasn't anything that you know, like would be truly like morally like monstrous or anything like that. But soft white nationalism is something that I think has become like much more common in, I guess there's different like gradations of it, right? Like soft white nationalism is basically just advocating for white interests overall. So that could be, okay, you know, opposing immigration from the third world because you're against, you know, the country becoming less white. Or it could be, you know, opposing affirmative action on identitarian grounds that it hurts white people. So this is something that has always kind of been in the Republican Party, I guess, like since Nixon's Southern Strategy, you know, to some extent, like dog whistling. To some extent, it was explicit, more so at certain times than at others. But I would say that it tends to be something that you tend to get like a lot of Republicans saying things like, you know, like hardworking Americans. Like they'll use like certain dog whistles, right, to connote identity issues. It's kind of soft white nationalism. The alt-right was about rejecting that and making it more formalist, which I think a lot of rationalists can appreciate.
So one of the first things I want to focus on is what exactly does it mean to have interests of white people? Because I see white people as just this big group, you know, it's a diaspora.
That's a great question. So there were two like object level policy issues that I think really animated us. Maybe you could say three. One was affirmative action. Another one was immigration. So, you know, just wanting to maintain the ethnic, you know, supermajority in America. And then I would say free speech was another one. When you have a multiracial society, you need to have stricter speech norms of courtesy and everything to kind of, it's easier for people to get offended because of like a misunderstanding or something. So typically when you have even when you have like men and women in the same group, right? Like men tend to like censor themselves a bit more. So it's like, I think the kind of idea is, even though theoretically like a libertarian could just support free speech or a rationalist, you know, like outside of the context of multiracialism or anything like that, it tends to be easier to have free speech when you have a more homogeneous community.
It doesn't have to be necessarily based on racial homogeneity. It could be cultural homogeneity, right? I can't pronounce that word.
Exactly. And that's an understanding I've come to, you know, over the past few years. It's made me less of a white nationalist. Yes.
Okay. So I want to focus on just like one, because whenever I come across the phrase like the interests and rights of white people, I just I don't have a way of grasping that because I don't know what that means. It's just like too many people in the same group.
Let me contextualize it like this though, like political control over the country, right? Like look at the cause of the Civil War.
What does that look like?
So let me give you an example. Look at the Civil War. Why is it that the South seceded? Right. It was ultimately because Abraham Lincoln wasn't saying he was going to free the slaves. Right. It was because he won without a single Southern electoral vote, right? And that's incredibly scary, the fact that you're losing control of the country. Now go back to the political environment of 2014. What was happening at the time? You had all these think pieces.
Wait, hold on. When you say because you're losing the country, who are you talking about? white people?
Yes, like your electoral votes no longer matter.
I mean, but you're talking about Southern white people, though.
Well, I'm giving an example to contextualize it, right? Okay. So it's about losing. So the Civil War is an example of Southerners feeling like they lost control over the country, so they needed to rebel. They needed to secede. Right.
Right. So just a pause. Like I understand what that means, because you can further describe what Southern white people's interests are. So they have an interest in upholding slavery. They have an interest in upholding the plantation system. They have like a particular culture that is this weird mix of dueling and whatever you want to call it for it. But you can kind of like grasp at certain cultural tenets are shared, broadly speaking, with Southern whites. It's just like the bigger the group, the less diluted it becomes, I guess. And I just don't know what when you say interest, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, so let me explain to you in these terms, because I do broadly agree with what you're saying in terms of my own politics. But let me explain to you how I felt at the time. Okay. So at the time, Romney had just gotten clobbered by Obama, right? And everyone was saying that the reason was because the Republican Party is losing. It has no appeal to non-whites, basically. Mm-hmm. Both sides of the spectrum, right and left, were saying at the time that Hispanic immigration would make it impossible for the Republicans to win the popular vote ever again. Now we know that's dumb, because the Republican Party has kind of shifted in its aesthetics and its style to appeal more to Hispanics. And it's done so very successfully. If you look at polling, you know, it's now getting close to like 40-60 or 50-50. It's going to, you know, 2024 is going to look a lot more like 2004 or 1984 than it did, you know, like 2012 or you know, 2008 in terms of the racial demography. But, you know, at the time I didn't realize this. I was a much younger man. And especially, you know, whenever they would give a statistic like, oh, you know, by 2060, America is going to be, you know, majority non-white, like the audience would cheer, right? There was this incredible hatred. I, you know, as a young man, I would hear like, you know, like minority women, like in my classes saying things about, oh, that's such a white man opinion. You know, and like, look, I'm a disagreeable person by nature. And when you hear that kind of stuff all the time, and when you hear like, you know, Colbert's audience like clapping about whites becoming a minority, I don't know. It feels cuckolded not to fight back against that and say, no, fuck you. Fuck you. I'm proud to be white. Fuck you. I'm a white nationalist. It's the same way that women are now, you know, reacting. They're getting very negatively polarized against the Republican abortion bans. Like after Roe v. Wade, a lot of women are now indicating on polls that they support abortion in all circumstances, even up to birth, right? Like this is something that nobody had that opinion before. But when you feel like you're being attacked, you get polarized and you get radicalized in an extreme direction.
I can understand that kind of like on a superficial level, but there's kind of a countervailing problem on the left when they start talking about white supremacy culture. I'm sure you've seen like the diagrams. It was from the Smithsonian that said white culture is about being on time. White culture is about scientific progress. And it sounds so insane when they say shit like that. And that's what happens when you start getting more specific about what does it mean to have white culture. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, keep going.
It seems like a stand-in for something else. Like we just say white. Some people would like, I guess, lower resolution way of talking. They just say white people as a stand-in for successful, intelligent, rational, smart family, whatever. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, right? Because on some people on like my side of the community would say yes, that's true, and they would reduce it to HBD, right? Like purely like. Mm-hmm. Like even have like non-white nationalists who are sort of like IQ nationalists who are very much, you know, and like they'll be in favor of like some Asian immigration, and they're, you know, they're thinking of things very much in terms of HBD. Whereas for me, I have a bit more of a sort of a spiritual or aesthetic. Even when I was a white nationalist, my understanding was I took IQ seriously and I thought it was important, but I thought there was something more fundamental, which is, you know, what Richard Spencer used to call the Faustian spirit. And it's the thing in Western European culture where there's a greater emphasis on like taking risks, calculated risks, a greater emphasis on a sense maybe of like personal honor and glory, a sense of like, you know, having some like fanciful, like, you know, like, you see in like memes from like Black people Twitter, like, you know, they'll say things like, oh man, white people crazy. They go out climbing Mount Everest. I ain't never do that shit. Like, you know, like that's the sort of thing that white people are proud of, right? That we go take risks and we'll do crazy shit all the time. Or like, you know, like you say, it's common on like Black people Twitter to make fun of like, you know, white people in scary movies for like going to go fight the monster at the beginning of the movie. You know what I mean? Like that's just sort of shit. But the, like, I mean, white nationalists love that.
Sure. But in each instance, race is a sort of a proxy, right? The most that you can say is that If we, you know, examine racial categories and then examine this particular trait, we might potentially see some association with some races versus, but not in others. Is that fair?
That's true. It is. But the thing is, like, okay, so I'm sort of rationalist adjacent in my like.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this podcast aesthetic is kind of like rationalist adjacent. We don't need to like get into rationality.
Yeah, speaking, I guess, but I like the rationalist approach to defining things in a very explicit formalist way like that. But like most normies are just too stupid to do that, right? And what normies, like, look, you just have to talk about like whites and non-whites. And now the thing is, like, I tend to have a pretty, like, even when I was a white nationalist, like I was always the one saying that, you know, like we should let in like Arabs and Persians and, you know, like Levantine people and Berbers, like, you know, like I have a pretty expansive definition of whiteness, and I myself am white.
Thank you for that.
No, I mean, like, look, someone who would like exclude like Richard Hanania, has probably done more for white people than like anybody over the past 3 years.
Okay. I guess we're back to,
I mean, I think I think this is an important point to make, actually, is because I think that oftentimes in American politics, the white people who are the most anti-white are super pale, like Scandinavian women from like Minnesota, or like, you know, like those German, like those, the WASPs are the ones who are pushing anti-whiteness, whereas it tends to be like Arabs and Russians and, you know, Persian, like those are the ones who tend to be much more like pro-white, or castizos, right? Because I wonder why. Maybe it's because it's like historically their whiteness has been more like suspect, so it's more like aspirational, or maybe there's like more of a sense of like that you can get away with it more in the discourse. I think there's like different factors, but I mean, it's because of that like I would never exclude somebody, you know?
Well, I have some theories as to like why white people tend to be the most critical of white people, especially like, you know, liberals. They're just like, oh man, aren't white people the worst? I'm the worst. You know, way of presenting yourself as like one of the good ones within this ideological framework.
I think it's a way of getting prestige too, because if you sort of like shit on yourself, it implies you have like a lot of surplus to burn.
Yeah, that makes sense too. Trace, did you want to say anything? I have like four follow-up questions, but...
Yeah, I mean, what you were saying about the whole Faustian stuff really struck me. I mean, obviously that's one of the things that really struck a chord with people when I was pulling some snippets from your article, is this idea of...
I see Faustian.
Yeah, no, this idea of white people as these feisty Faustians and then going to places that are full of white people and being like, hold on, these people aren't really like that. And that really struck me because that's not ever personally a impression I had of white people. I grew up in an extremely white area. I grew up in what would be very much this like right-wing white nationalist paradise space, in a sense, in that, you know, I'm growing up in this stable, religious, extremely ethnically homogenous, extremely culturally homogenous space. And like your experience with the Midwest, my experience with Mormon suburban Utah was anything but this idea of Faustian spirit, this idea of like edginess, this idea of any of that. It was very much this stable, don't rock the boat, be safe, be careful culture. And I don't know that I have ever associated or ever really heard associated with white people specifically this idea of having like, so when I hear honor culture, things like that, you know, my mind goes to say the Middle East, goes to Arabic countries, particularly back in the day, goes to the Southern United States, goes to a lot of environments like that, not necessarily anything to do with ethnicity so much as very specific cultural contexts.
Yes, a few things. I think you have to make a distinction between whites in and outside of what's called the Heinel line. Have you heard of that?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Right, of course. So cis Heinel whites are I don't want to say they're my
enemies. Can you briefly explain the line?
Yeah, of course. So there's if you look at European demography, there's a line that kind of runs throughout like I guess northern Spain and central Italy, and it also excludes Ireland and excludes most of Eastern Europe. And it's basically within the line, you tend to have white people marrying at an older age, kind of in their mid 20s. You don't have big age gaps between men and women. You don't see like women being married off like, you know, in the pubescent years as much. You tend to see bans on things like cousin marriage, whereas outside the line, you know, everyone's marrying their cousins when they're like 14 years old. And, you know, it tends to be much more kind of tribal and freewheeling and everything. And whites inside the Heinel line are probably a lot more civilized. They're the kind of like German Nebraskan types who, you know, just, yeah, they get married to their high school girlfriend and then they, you know, go live a very civilized life and they'll make like $80,000 a year and go to Renza and every weekend. And I don't know, like the whole like very like low stakes, like Huskers fan hobbit mentality, which, you know, I don't want to hate on that too much, because it's like what you have to understand about my essay, and the reason it went so viral was because it was speaking from the heart, from the place of like just like an insecure young guy who was like, I was very much channeling who I was at the time and kind of channeling that hatred. It was sort of like an artistic choice, I guess. But I think it spoke to a lot of people, because there were a lot of Midwesterners in the comment, like you'll see, Trace, in the comments of your thread, there are a ton of people saying, yeah, this is accurate, but like they might be making fun of me, or they might be saying this is a good thing. But like, I think it was an accurate characterization.
I think it was a perceptive essay.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was sort of like, that's the problem with art, is that like, you know, my rhetorical style isn't very rationalist, in the sense that I do lean into hyperbole. I do lean into, I don't know, irony. I make certain choices that I know are going to have a big dramatic impact, but which also sometimes make it hard to really define my point and engage with people, so that it's very clear what it is that I'm saying. So it can be difficult. And even the way I talk, you can tell now, I'm a very rambly sort of, I don't know. It's hard. Like I think I touch
on this. Would it have been fair to frame your push towards white nationalism at the time and the alt-right as an aesthetic sense, as just this feels like the aesthetic that I want type of thing?
No, because I genuinely did feel that it was a problem that, you know, like on, like you can't have a country where the founding stock is just mocked on national television, and everyone says, and it's just like common for like, I don't know, like chubby Hispanic women in your sociology class to like talk about how she hates white people, and you just have to put up with that. Like, fuck that. No, I'm glad. I'm proud of what I did. I'm proud of everything I did in the alt-right. However, I think that times have changed. I don't think things are bad for white people anymore. And I think that it's not like race is not nearly as politically salient as it used to be. And I think it's
when you say things were bad for white people, do you mean more than just like getting mocked in like a sociology class, or is there like a material component?
Well, yeah. I mean, affirmative action. I mean, we've made a huge amount of progress on affirmative action. I would say immigrant, but like, no, like what you have to understand.
Do you think it's white people that are hurt by affirmative action?
I mean, obviously Asians and Indians are probably hurt somewhat more. I'd say that in terms of like overall quantity, it's white people who are hurt the most, but in terms of like an individual's direct impact. But I would say, obviously white people are the most hurt just in overall quantity. Yeah.
I mean, that's an empirical question. I don't know if we'll get to it. My personal theory about affirmative action is that it's advocated primarily by, I guess you would say, mid white people that are afraid of Asian competition. So whatever brings down Asian competition, like, will advantage white people as well as advantage, like, I guess, Black and Hispanic categories.
I see what you mean. I see what you mean.
Yeah, no, I don't know that I'd agree with that. So personally, I think that I have a lot of irritable thoughts about affirmative action, but the core of it for me, I don't think that it does advantage mediocre white people in any meaningful way. What I think it does is ultimately it gives college admissions officers the system that we have in place is the result of a tension between college admissions officers' preferences and the law. And whatever feints people make about affirmative action, ultimately what college admissions officers want is going to rule the day. And what they want is basically an racially diverse group of students with the right amount of underrepresented minorities and the right amount of others. Before affirmative action, explicitly, they wanted that. After affirmative action has been banned, they still want that. And while that group is in place, like, their goal is not to advantage mediocre white people. Their goal is not to explicitly disadvantage Asians, although that is absolutely the impact of it. They have sincere, high-minded ideals with it. But basically what it comes down to in terms of impact is whatever admissions system they are allowed to have, as long as they can't have explicit quotas, they will find whatever way necessary to approximate those quotas.
Yeah, and it seems like part of the motivation is they're uncomfortable, I guess, with – if they have just like a merit-based system, you end up with a particular racial mix. And that looks really bad for just like as a PR perspective for the university.
Well, but it's also like there is something to the whole like personality thing, right? Like I do think that if you only let people in completely based on test scores, like you do just have an aspect in Asian culture where they're more willing to grind. And like, that is just going to kind of lower the social experience for a lot of people, you know, because these days, like it or not, like a lot of people are just going to college, you know, to get laid or to party or whatever. And right. like that is part of the economic aspect of it. And I don't know, it's a tricky thing because I do sympathize with Asians who say, who make the kind of argument that you did that like, yeah, like with like affirmative action actually sort of helps. Like I helps white people. I do sort of understand where you're coming from in that sense. And I do think that if you were to get rid of the existing scheme of affirmative action and make it purely merit-based, I think a lot of white people would move against it more harshly than they do now because there's just too many Asians. I think that's actually the case. And I think less so like Northeast Asians than you're going to see especially like Brahmin Indians just completely taking over.
What you're touching on with, you know, people being too willing to grind, so forth, people wanting to go to college just for the experience. I look at that, and the thing I really dislike about some of these elite universities, about some mm-hmm. of these Ivy League universities, is that people accept that as, okay, and this is what a top university should do. Like, I think that if you want to say, oh, we are admitting the best people, we are admitting the most serious people, what you need to be prepared to do is say, yes, we will have whatever culture results from people being absolutely committed to rise to the top.
And what seriousness that looks is like always the best. Sometimes you want people who want to party. Sometimes you get the best ideas, like, you know, getting high at 2 a.m. with, you know, some random girl you just hooked up with. And then, like, you know, that'll make, like, the best blog post of the century, right? I mean, sometimes you need you need people who are a little chaotic. You need people who are more, sometimes a bit more artistic, a bit more, you want other things than just, you know, optimizing for, like, a perfect score in the SAT.
And my response is, I don't know that the very top ones do. All those people don't disappear. It's not like when once one university rejects someone, they disappear and go to a different place. And it's not like scoring high on the SAT is anti-correlated with any of those things. It's not like all the people who get the absolute top test scores are suddenly going to be dramatically less in the other domains. So by accepting a system where you say, yes, we will just say, all the best people filter up to Harvard, judged by Harvard trying to assemble the very coolest class for itself. And that's what it's going for, really. It's going for general, quote-unquote, coolness. It's not going for excellence. It's going for presenting an air of the elite. By allowing an ecosystem for that, you create a system where people do see getting into that university, getting into this very top university, as the peak thing that someone of that age can do. And it warps the entire incentive structure for childhood. Whereas if you just turn it into something where it is purely an academic game, purely how good are you? Can you make use of these specifically academic things that you
That's going to make everyone really autistic, though. I mean, think about it. Like, everyone will just be focused on, like you do want people, like, to have some social skills and to have some ability to, like, perceive nuance and subtext and, you know, create good art. And, I mean, look, I sympathize with what you're saying. Like, that would certainly have helped me out because I'm very spurgy myself. But I think that you do want an incentive structure that makes people care about coolness to some extent. Otherwise, like, I don't know, because like the sort of personality traits that make you cool are the same traits that make you, you know, good at raising venture capital, that make you, you know, like good at like controlling a meeting, like handling like board members or something like that. I mean, like these are all things that, you know, correlate with success in the capitalist world. And I think that like just being narrowly, like I think IQ is important. I think academic, you know, whatever is important, but it's just only one part of the picture.
Well, so I'm not sure you're entirely addressing my specific argument here.
Trace, are we going down an education rabbit hole?
I know. I'm sorry. This is
an interesting topic, but I mean, yeah.
It's a topic. A little bit diverted.
I think it's mostly just an aesthetic difference, though, you know?
No, I know. There's one thing that I could recenter on, which is one thing I wanted to push back again. And I've talked about this in DMs with Walt, but I still want to push back with this because it's something that I wrestle with a lot. When you emphasize, Walt, how proud you are of that time frame and of your actions during that time frame, of the alt-right, mm-hmm. everything. You know, I understand from the inside having this whole growth experience, meeting friends, so forth, things like that. At the same time, the perspective that I'm coming from is one where as that movement was rising, I was watching some crass, unholy demon is what it looked like to me and what it still looks like to me, hollowing out from the inside everything that the values that I had seen espoused by the people around me claimed to be, trying to drag people towards something that still looks to me very grim and very dark. So you talk a lot about, you know, being proud of being white and everything. Yeah. A lot of the content was not about being proud of being white, anything like that, or being proud of your own culture, anything like that. And I, you know, I'm, like you've seen, I'm a little bemused and off-put by white as a category.
So, I mean, you also were raised in a Mormon culture where that's, like, you know, kind of very polite, right? I mean, like, I think that does kind of inform things, right? I was raised in a kind of, like, a Scotch-Irish aggressive, you know, like, we're making fun of each other is more of a... I mean, I think that...
Well, it's not just... Hold on. It's not just politeness. It's very much trying to make people see other races as bad people. Very much trying to build an association between immigrants and rape. Build an association between black people and criminality. Build an association between... Basically, trying to make people make sure that when they see individuals of other races, the first thing they think of is the negative traits associated with those groups on aggregate. That was a very objective goal of the alt-right. And so when you say you're proud of this, this is what I keep hearing, this is what I keep coming back to, is the idea of being proud of trying to build a culture of very, very direct negativity towards
sneering.
Others, very much sneering. And I don't understand being proud of that. I just don't.
So, okay. So what I'll speak to is this. I think that there was some content from back then, like the oven memes you would see in like the right stuff or something like that. Like the stuff that leaned into anything that was actually violent or like actually hateful, I tended to avoid that. And if you look at my own content, yeah, like some of it I would characterize as, I wouldn't really call it hateful. I would call it kind of like impetuous. I would call it kind of, you know, impertinent. I mean, I was a young man at the time. I was very much, it was like shock jock humor. The thing is, what you have to understand, though, is again, like I had been negatively polarized by constantly being attacked in my college courses for being a white male, by constantly seeing people cheering on national television for white people becoming a minority. In that sort of environment, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's again, it's like, wait, fuck me, fuck you too, right? Like that's how it felt. And
sure, but what I'll say is I experienced the same things. We are a similar age. We grew up in a similar environment. We grew up in a similar culture. And I was from a conservative culture. And I was from a religious culture that meant that I saw my people, my religion and everything being mocked constantly, being derided constantly. And I did not go down that route. So
why not? You should have.
What does that accomplish?
It accomplishes, look, Matt Iglesias and Noah Smith and all of those kind of center left people, when people to the left of them start attacking whites, they clamped down on that shit because they knew it just causes a thermostatic backlash. It just causes people to rise up against you.
So that's the thing. I always clamped down and I always criticized the things that people were doing. I criticized the negative trends. But at the same time, I saw the backlash and I saw the negative aspects of those backlash. And I criticized that too. Like, I didn't lean into that.
Let me interject real quick. For the record, I felt the same way. I saw so many articles that just say, oh, white people are so stupid, they're so boring or whatever. And I thought it was lame. I didn't like it. And I pushed back on that because I thought that one of the points was you are going to create a backlash. But I don't see the backlash as legitimate just because it's inevitable.
Well, here's the thing is that there's going to be different levels of the backlash. You're going to have people who are who never really like become enemies of society and who remain, who, they're radicalized, but you can reach out to them. And if you change the system, you can get them back in. And that's what happened to me. And basically, I think that becoming a radical was necessary in order to, because frankly, like it was an intransigent power structure that just hated white people, that hated, and you know, at the time I thought it was because of Jews. I've kind of changed my mind on that. I think now it's more, you get people in like in the Midwest who like sort of hick libs, right? Who were like picked on, by other white people, by, you know, chuddish white people when they're young. And then they go, you know, they get like a media job as an adult. And then like they tend to be very contemptuous of like middle America. And you know, they're the ones who are writing those articles. Yeah. But I mean, like that was a very common problem back then. And frankly, it just, look, like you don't see those articles coming out anymore. Right.
Well,
like,
hold on. But I do not think, and I'm actually very confident that it is not the alt-right that made those articles stop coming out, because I was in the quote unquote heterodox subculture. And what I was seeing were constantly people from the center and people from the center left pushing back and saying, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. I mean, Scott Alexander, for example, very early caught the wave and was saying, these things are very bad. These things should not happen. But what would happen every time, right, is that you would have very, very strong, very emphatic pushback from the center left. And then people would look and they would say, oh, but aren't you guys just saying the same thing that those guys over there who are talking about how the Jews are controlling everyone and how all of these other races are evil? And aren't you just saying the same things as those? And it made it much, much harder from the center and from the center left to push and to fight.
Hold on. Let's talk about the Jewish question for a second, because like, I think it's actually interesting. Because 10 years ago, you saw a lot of it was very common for right-wing Jews and left-wing Jews to both be opposed to white identity politics, right? Whereas these days, right-wing Jews tend to be kind of pro-white. Like Ben Shapiro, doesn't really counter-signal sort of soft white nationalism in the same way he did, you know, 10 years ago. And I think it's because right-wing Jews and just Zionists generally, they learned that you basically have to make an alliance with MAGA, and especially after the recent Gaza war. I mean, it's basically just baked into the cake at this point. It sort of brought right-wing Jews, and this is an argument I've made against white nationalists recently. You can look at my my podcast, the fifth episode of it. I was you know, advancing this argument against one of the most prominent white nationalists in the country right now. And, you know, I think this is an important, a very salient change that the alt-right helped produce, because we were telling a lot of these sort of elite neoconservative Jews who were anti-white identity politics for America, but pro-Israeli identity politics, hey, this is hypocritical. Same thing to a lot of left-wing media Jews who were still pro-Zionist. These days, left-wing Jews tend to be extremely anti-Zionist. So I think that calling out that hypocrisy was actually, it's something really only the alt-right could do. And of course, you know, like the movement died, but I think that effect in the discourse has remained. And I think it's you know, you can't deny the power of that.
I think, look, every potential positive thing that someone in the alt-right said, someone outside the alt-right was saying that also, and was saying it in a more careful, measured, emphatic
way. And
in a way that did make people listen, in a way that didn't make people treat them as monsters, except in as much as the alt-right managed to create an association between those things and, frankly, some really ugly ideas that then made everyone turn with suspicion towards those same people, wondering, are you one of these people that's suddenly going to be? And look, you mentioned, I think you look through your past content with rose-colored glasses a lot when you're talking about you didn't really lean into some of the really uglier stuff. Like, look at, say, your song Fall in Line, for example, where you know, are making this very clear portrayal of these puppet master Jews and these moronic black people, where these puppet masters are controlling these moronic black people against the white people. Like you very much leaned into those same tropes.
It's clear from your 85 IQ, you can't organize on your own. But with my cash backing dindos like you, I can keep the chosen on the throne. Fall in line and go tweet Black Lives Matter. Fall in line and set your town ablaze. We'll create the safe space by ending the white race.
And what do we get, fam?
More money for programs.
You very much leaned into those same tropes.
It was serious specifically. I mean, like, yeah, but there is a certain type of, I mean, it's true, though. There is a certain type of, like, Jewish person in the media who, especially at the time, was like very ferociously anti-white. And it's just like empirically true that they had leadership positions in a lot of like anti-white organizations. I mean, the SPLC, the ADL.
It's empirically true that they had leadership positions in the anti-Semitic organizations. Like, that's what happens. You know, you have, for heaven's sake, Unz.com, Ron Unz, BAP, all of these extremely anti-Semitic people were also Jewish. Like,
yeah. That's the interesting thing. And I mean, I personally knew one of my best friends at the time. He was half Jewish and he was one of the most important people in the alt-right. I mean, yeah, it's sort of a thing. It's kind of a funny thing. Like, you know, having the high verbal IQ, especially having the sort of the argumentative traits of Ashkenazi culture. It tends to lean into kind of contrarianism will lean into anti-Semitism. It's kind of a funny dynamic of it.
Right. So when you're saying, you know, oh, yeah, I'm just making these things about the evil Jews controlling the stupid black people, and I'm proud of making these things about the evil Jews controlling the stupid black people, because there were evil Jews controlling them and people needed to know about those evil Jews. But, you know, now I'm going to take a more measured tone with it all. Like,
I
can see why that rubs me wrong.
Discourse works as different groups in society push back at each other and they're fighting. And I mean, like, that's like, I don't view any group as a permanent enemy or a permanent ally. The way I view it, politics are coalitional, and you know, like you're constantly having forces, that are in opposition, and that are like right now, I'm in terms of like the dissident right or whatever you want to call it. I don't really like that term, but it's what people say. Like, I'm probably one of the most philo-Semitic voices, and I'm saying that it's good for white people to compete with Ashkenazi Jews. That's why American whites were so vital and so Faustian in the 20th century. Why the same thing applied to Victorian Britain, and why like today I support Brahmin immigration into, you know, the tech scene, because I think it probably is a big thing that produced like the rationalist culture. And you know, I had several Indian American guests on my podcast, and it was really interesting hearing their perspectives about how to like rule as an elite. and how the Brahmin were able to do that and effectively almost become like their own race, right, in India for thousands of years. I think these things are really important perspectives that white people need to adopt. And I think one of the things that's made white people great historically is ironically diversity. The fact that we were much more pluralistic than Asians, for instance, instead of uniting into just like Han China, this one, you know, conglomerate, we instead competed with one another in different sort of fractious nation states, and that produced a lot of technological innovation and growth. Similarly, America was always very open to immigration, and I think that the immigrant cultures tended to be the most vital, and they tended to be. So I'm broadly like pro-immigration, right, and especially elite immigration. And I'm broadly philo-Semitic. I mean, I basically like only date Jewish women at this point. Like, personally, sure, I love. It's like think about that.
I get that, and I appreciate that, and I read through a lot of your positions now, and I think that you have you are headed in an interesting direction with a lot of them. You have interesting ideas with a lot of them, and you're right, you are absolutely making more overtures to these groups, things like that. The tension that I'm wrestling with is that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, repeatedly, very thoroughly emphasizing how proud you were to really try to make people hate those groups, because you did. Because whatever you can say, you did. You absolutely looking, and I listened to your songs from that time. I looked through all of them, tried through, you know, trying to say, is this guy just trying to, you know, build this healthy ethos for himself, whatever? And it wasn't. Like, you were absolutely very much trying to spread very direct hatred towards individuals of other groups. You absolutely were.
I could find five Jews in the next hour who would find my videos hilarious.
Sure, I'm sure you could. But do you see the tension here between saying, on the one hand, now you are philo-Semitic and now you are pro-immigration, these things like that, but you also really love your old videos, really find them hilarious, and really think that,
I think you're sort of shaped by your own aesthetics and by your own upbringing, which is like very big on like, because think about it, like Mormon culture historically has been about like avoiding. Like Mormons were afraid of being genocided, right? So for so long in their history, that's why they escaped and built this sort of like quasi ethno state in Utah. I think that there's a sort of paranoia about like trying to avoid conflict with other groups and being as nice as possible. That's why Mitt Romney was kind of a cuck, and how he wasn't willing to like go like full knuckle brawling with Obama in the way he should have. He was too much of a gentleman, and I think you're being too much of a gentleman right now. I think that
hold on. Am I being too much of a gentleman by coming on and confronting you directly and saying you can call me many things, and
it seems to be the opposite. Yeah.
right. No, I'm being, I think, very directly confrontational and very emphatic in defense of my own beliefs, which are that what you did back then was ugly and bad. And yes, it may have carried benefits for you, but the negative externalities affected people like me and affected people who were actively trying to build a healthier culture. And I understand that now you are trying to build a healthier culture. But I think, just like I would say to someone who was a communist back in the day and then softened towards liberalism, but still loved their communist phase and still talked about how proud they were about cheering on Mao Zedong and so forth, I would say, no, screw that. Mao Zedong was evil. If you want to join a different side, you have to join a different side. You can't be speaking out of one side of your mouth saying, oh, I love Mao Zedong and I really loved that revolution and I loved my time as a young Maoist and everything, but now I'm ready to join and be a liberal. Like, on the one hand, I recognize the need for a soft off-ramp, but on the other hand, at some point, you need to look at that communist and you need to say, no, Mao Zedong was actually evil, and supporting that, there was an actual problem there.
Okay, so a few things. Number one, I think when you look back at the old right, I think too many people are looking at what happened in 2015 to 2016 in the light of what happened in like 2017 to 2018. Now, I was never involved with the second half of the movement. I was always against the retard rallies, you know, IRL, Charlottesville. Like, I always thought, well, I wasn't against it at the time. I should say that. I thought it was a good idea. But, like, I never participated in that. And, you know, as it started getting going, I was like, okay, this is not really productive. So I basically backed out of the movement. But I think a lot of the negative effects that you're thinking about were associated with that second period.
Absolutely not. No. Sorry to cut you off. But no, I am talking about, because 2015 to 2016 was my own time of political awakening. And it was as someone who was watching the Republican Party that I had grown up in and watched espousing one set of values and believing one set of values. I watched it be flipped inside out and told that, no, actually, we are about all these really ugly things that everyone had always accused us of being about. And I had been emphatically, no, we're not. The people
around us love this for a time now. And we got great press coverage before we started letting all the stupid chuds in. And I think, frankly,
great press coverage from a very, from a very select subset. Like, I can tell you from my position where I was, you know, this not super politically awake, naive centrist-ish, trying to decide which party everything that the coverage that I saw of you guys from 2015 and the experience that I saw of this whole, like, Trump movement rising up was very, very negative. The whole time, my impression of it, there was never a point where I was like, oh, no, this is cool, this is positive. It was always this. Oh, okay.
I think this is a nuanced thing that I want to break down very carefully, because I sort of agree with what you're saying in retrospect, and I sort of strongly disagree. But it's, I need to separate these two points out. Because on one hand, I do agree that the Republican Party let in a certain kind of, I don't know, like winner-take-all, like epistemic nihilism, a sort of like cynical grifter mentality. And I think we leaned into that. Because, like Trump sort of played the alt-right, because we were like, most of us were very intellectual guys, very nerdy, very very sort of like concerned with the truth. But a lot of us came out of the Ron Paul movement, and we were so upset to see how Ron Paul was marginalized by the neocons. And that's incidentally a big motivating factor for anti-Semitism, was because of how Ron Paul was treated. You know, like we were so upset by the whole Ron Paul situation that I think we sort of like turned against the idea of being earnest. It's funny. Ron Paul's middle name was literally Ernest, but we went against being earnest. We went against being genuine. We went against being, I guess, just sort of naive in that sense, and just kind of, I don't know, like really just trying to push for a very civic minded kind of politics. And instead, we leaned into the darkness of the, like, Steve Bannon, like, you know, grenade throwing, you know, like that aspect of Trump. But we loved it whenever he humiliated Jeb Bush, right? Whenever he called Bush a cuck, it unleashed some kind of, and that caused us to ignore the fact that he was just taking advantage of us in the same way. He used the alt-right as a sort of rhetorical toehold into the, you know, elite discourse. And a lot of like elite young Republicans, you know, became white nationalists kind of on a crypto level. And like, that's what kind of destroyed the Tea Party energy and got it like repurposed into MAGA. Now, in the long run, that was horrible, because the alt-right, after the alt-right died, there wasn't an intellectual element to it anymore. And it basically became about nothing but cynical grifting at the top and resentment from proles at the bottom. And I'm disgusted by the modern MAGA Republican Party. I think MAGA is a completely vacuous movement. I have no time for it. And I've spent most of my time on Substack, you know, on invective against MAGA. So, I mean, you know, I agree with everything there. However, I think that you needed that Nietzschean element to some extent. I do think you needed some sort of, like, there's too much of an aspect in the, like, the sort of, like, Republican Party you talk about growing up with, like, that there wasn't a will to power there. There wasn't a respect for strength. There wasn't a respect for taking your own fucking side when people are insulting you. And I'm sorry, like, I don't mean this as a personal attack at all, but I grew up among Mormons in Mesa, Arizona. I grew up seeing how they would react when people would, frankly, treat them like shit. Like, sometimes, like, people would make fun of their religion, but there comes a certain point where you just need, when someone does that to you, you need to break their fucking nose, you know, like you need to take your own side and stand up for yourself. And I feel like they're just, I get really sad. Like, when I look at rationalists today, the way they get made fun of by, like, Sneer Club, right? The way they get made fun of by little mean girls. No, like, fuck them. Fuck.
I mean, Sneer Club is lame. Like, I tried to mix it up with them and they just blocked me because I don't think they can take any criticism. I'll
tell you what happened with me on Sneer Club. I found the guys who were on Sneer Club. I found a podcast that one of them had gone on with one of his left-wing buddies, and he went on and bagged about the rationalists and talked about some freaking stupid things. I reached out to the dude. I had a great conversation with the dude. I went on the same podcast, talked about topics I care about, and had a fantastic conversation with the guy, bagging on his buddy who was a drunk loser who just yelled at online people all the time. Like, so what I did, I just, you know, they were beneath my attention.
Well, see, here's the thing, Trace, is I think you need, I hate to use the whole, like, Malcolm X, MLK analogy, because that's kind of tired, but I really do think you need people of both of our temperaments. You know, you need the fighter and you need the diplomat in order to make real progress. And I see what you're saying. Like, there were certain optical choices that the alt-right made that were terrible, that I think
not just optical.
Well, okay, here's the thing, is that I know, like, basically all of the, like, elite figures in the movement from, like, 2015 to 2016. Like, I like met with most of them privately. Like, nobody was a bad person. Like, these are not people who, like, really hated anybody. I mean, half of them were
communists, and they're not bad people. Their ideas are bad. We fight not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. It's the ideas.
But the attacks get to flesh and blood. And when you attack flesh and blood, that just radicalizes people. And that just makes them, look, if you're not going to let me into the discourse to take my own side, then fuck you, I'm a radical. And that's where I was. And I don't think I deserve to be, like, I don't think you should ever demand that someone apologize for their past, you know, when they were in that state of radicalization. And because you yourself were pissed off at those articles coming out at the time, I mean, I think you have to understand emotionally why people became white nationalists, and you need to give them the grace of like, yeah, maybe they said a few things that they wouldn't say, you know, as an adult. But it's like,
okay, there's many reasons why someone would become a white nationalist. And just to go back to your point about, I guess, backlash, there's many ways to resist and engage in reprisals, engage in countering that are misdirected, right? Just because someone reacts, doesn't like being insulted, shamed, humiliated, doesn't mean that their reaction is necessarily legitimate. There's different ways of reacting. Some are more constructive than others.
I think ours was constructive because the culture changed very easily. Because people are afraid of causing a backlash, and now you see in media environments there's a very strong tendency to avoid like direct anti-white identity politics, and I think that's because people want to prevent another alt-right from forming.
Okay, I just want to introduce like an example. Hopefully, it will illustrate, I guess, what I'm thinking about this. So you mentioned immigration, and when I talk to white nationalists, white supremacists, that often comes up as like they want to limit bad immigration. Typically, there's like a background argument saying that, third world immigrants tend to have low IQ. We don't want low IQ. We want high IQ immigrants like from Europe. That's like the background assumption. I'm not going to contest it. I don't care. Just assuming that that's true, assuming that there's a discrepancy in IQ and immigration.
Yeah.
Well, pick a random low IQ country. I don't care.
Uganda.
Okay. So let's say like you know, the alt-right wins on immigration. They implement their preferred immigration system that limits bad immigrants. You get they say we don't want immigrants from Uganda because they're on average their IQ is too low. You get this guy that comes in saying, "Hey, I want to immigrate to this country," and they're like, "Sorry, we have a spreadsheet. You're on the Uganda list. We don't want you here." And he says, "Well, I'm actually like a quantum physicist. I have a Nobel Prize in this field." And they say, "No, sorry. Like you're from Uganda that has an average IQ level." So to me, that just seems like insane. Like if you accept the premise,
the argument at the time was regression to the mean, right? And the idea is that different races, their kids are going to regress more to their racial mean. And especially if you look at like if you control for IQ, like you still see discrepancies in like savings rate in criminality, aggression. I mean, things like that.
What? So you're saying just. Okay. So like this hypothetical Ugandan Nobel Prize winner, his kids would be retards or something?
Not that they'd be retards. They'd probably have like 115 IQs and like they might get arrested in high school for, you know, like breaking a window or something. I'm not saying that they're going to be like, you know, retarded or they're going to be like criminals. I'm saying that they're not going to be as exceptional as he is. And the same thing would apply to a white physicist, right? But the difference is probably going to be a little bit smaller.
Now, sure, but we're not testing it whether they're exceptional compared to him. We're testing it, I guess, compared to what was the native stock, right?
Yes, but it's still, I mean, like you have to hold immigrants to a different standard, obviously, right? Like they should have to be more exceptional. But at least that was my idea at the time. Like, look, I don't really.
Sure. Like I'm granting that. I'm just trying to understand like this is what I tend to encounter with this type of argumentation. There's like these low resolution filters, like such as IQ and just looking at, I guess, country averages or, it comes up in crime too. They'll say some races commit more crimes than other. And then I just ask, okay, assuming that that's true, what next? What do you want to do next? And I have so many proposals for high resolution filters. I say, okay, do you want to have like immigration that is strictly based on IQ? Okay, that's fine. That's at least like more targeted. For crime, I just say, assuming that it's true that some races commit more crimes than other, what do you want to do about that now? Do you want to like preemptively imprison people if they're the wrong race? Do you want to have like a lower evidentiary standard?
That's what the drug war was, and preemptively imprisoning people, and that's why the crime rate went down. I mean, it's sad to say, but it's like, it's subtextual, and that's another reason I sort of drifted away from white nationalism.
But it's just like so circuitous. You instead of directly addressing an issue, you just kind of like say, well, how about we use this proxy for a proxy for a proxy?
Well,
and
you
hopefully
know why?
That addresses the
issue.
That's
how it works in the real world. And that it's kind of sad, but the rationalist approach of being direct doesn't work because in terms of like direct political, people will just think you're like weird or autistic if you focus on certain things that are like no-nos, right? They're these big bad boy things you're not allowed to talk about. So
let me just put the punchline and then we can continue.
Yeah.
What I suspect is that people are just, they just don't like black people, or they don't like certain immigrants, they don't like certain races, but they don't want to say that outright. They know that, they realize that it's vacuous position to hold just on aesthetics. So they try to dress it up in this plausible justification. They'll say, no, it's not that I'm against immigrants, I just don't like low IQ immigrants. But then when you offer, it's like, okay, how about IQ tests for all immigrants? They're like, no, like they just get like annoyed. They don't want to implement that system because it doesn't give them the direct what their actual like protectual goal, which is, I just don't want non-white people in this country.
Okay, I agree with you in large part, but I think that it should be more legitimate to just say, I don't want non-white people in my country, and it doesn't have to be a hateful.
That's fine. I don't care. I just the problem I have is that it's a pretextual excuse. I just want, if someone is going to be a bigot, I just want them to tell me, like, I just don't like your people here.
I don't
want this particular group in this country, instead of like try to dress it up with this like bullshit lie of, oh no, I just care about the health of the country and whatnot.
Well, okay, hold on. I agree with you to some extent, but I also do think there is, in certain populations, like the average IQ is just like so low that it could cause problems if you're not like, I think if you're selecting heavily for IQ to begin with, then it's not an issue. Like you can just find a subgroup, like an elite subgroup, and it's fine. But when it comes to mass immigration, it's a little bit different. And then I think the population differences do matter more. But I mean, that's less what I want to talk about. Like, did you ever read that book? I think it was called like White Lash by Eric Kaufman or something like that. I think you guys probably will have heard of that.
I haven't heard of it.
Okay. Well,
but anyway, I might be familiar with the ideas.
The idea of the book is basically that when you stigmatize like very non-hateful and just very like normal identity politics from white people, that's what's going to create like this exaggerated form of like white nationalism that doesn't have to be there. Like you need to create a rhetorical like space where white people are allowed to just advocate for their own interests, and it's not seen as bad because you just use the words white people, right? And that's why like I'm still, a lot of liberals in Trace's thread called me a white nationalist. They say he's still a white nationalist because I didn't renounce the idea of that. I still think that white people should be able to advocate as white people for their own interests. However, I don't think that should be the crux of all political activity. So I'm not even a soft white nationalist anymore. But I think that you need to create that space, or else you're going to make people feel like, what, I can't even like advocate for my own interests? Well, fuck everything then, right? Like you need to avoid that happening. And the way to do that is to make it okay for white people to say, no, I do just want the country to remain like at least 70%, 60% white. And like, I think we should stop mass immigration from the third world for that reason. Like that should not be considered like this hateful, horrible thing to say.
I respect that position because it's honest and direct. What I don't respect is hiding your actual position through this cloud. So one of the core issues is when you're saying it's okay for white people to advocate for their interests, whatever that means. I'm not going to revisit that yet. How do you determine who's being honest and who's just trying to mask their just blatant bigotry?
I don't think whether they're being honest should matter as much. I think you just need to look, like, politics should not be this thing. Politics is transactional, number one, and politics is coalitional. When I'm looking at a political objective,
just a quick correction, it's not whether or not they're honest. It's more, how do you know? It's more about like knowing what they actually really want. They could just be putting up a mask. Well, because they could be putting up a mask and pursuing a pretextual excuse or a pretextual goal.
I mean, that's what probably most people are doing anyway. I don't think you should care about that. I think you should just care about results.
Well, like, yeah, that's part of the results.
Like, everyone does pretextual stuff. Like, politics is like inevitably shaped by all these little like rules of what you are and aren't allowed to talk about. Like anything that's you know, adjacent to race or like gender or sex or the incel question, or there's a lot of things that are low prestige to talk about, so you have to talk around them. And that's what everyone, like, I hated this as a long time, and that's why I'm so sympathetic to rationalism. I was a libertarian. I've been interested in all these very autistic, very like masculine style sort of, but it's funny, it was being on the Red Scare subreddit that kind of taught me like women don't really think about things in that way, and they don't. It's much more implicit with them. So my point is, especially like once women have the franchise, you really can't talk about politics directly. And it's not like you shouldn't just resent women for this. It's just like women are always so concerned with, okay, is this comment going to like make these guys start fighting? Right. They're always trying to like cool that shit down. Right.
Okay. Assuming that it's true that you can't talk about things directly, the core issue still remains. How do you know what people are pursuing? And going back to the immigration example, if someone says, I'm just worried about like uneducated masses, like low skilled workers coming into this country, dragging the standard of living down, then if I accept that that's true, if they're being honest and earnest about their goals, then I say, okay, we can work together. Let's discuss some proposals that target this issue. And I say, okay, let's do IQ testing for immigration. And then the reaction from them, if they don't actually hold that position in earnest, instead, if they just want an aesthetic preference for white people, they're going to be squirmy. They're going to say, well, no, I don't want that. And they'll make up a reason for why they don't support it. So that's my issue, is that I don't know when people are being honest because I don't know what they're pursuing.
I guess I would just push back again, and I would say, like, why can't you just focus on the short-term goal where you do have an overlap and agreement, and then just you don't have to be best friends with them. Right.
It's more like I can't tell what their goal is. So I don't know how I'm supposed to coordinate with them.
That's fair enough. And that's why one of my big things has been, I want to normalize white identity politics as just a normal fact of American life in a way that's not hateful or weird or countercultural or oppositional in any way. It's just I'm a white person. I support white interests, but I'll also work with Asians and Indians and whatever to promote interests where we have an overlap. I mean, it's just a very, I don't know, I think it should be coalitional and transactional. That would be my response. And I'm not that concerned with honesty or good faith or, whatever myself, as long as I know, someone's not going to betray me in a very callous, short-term way for no, I feel comfortable just not being that concerned with long-term intentions. Cause I expect everyone's going to lie. That's another thing is I feel like everyone's constantly lying and not in a mean-spirited Mr. Burns rubbing his hands together sort of way, but more just for courtesy, right? Everyone is sort of just conforming to courtesy norms without even really trying or thinking about it. And that results in people sort of misstating their position in a way that rationalists would find objectionable, in order to just smooth over little frictions in everyday interaction.
Trace, do you want to jump in on anything?
Yeah, in terms of this idea of, having a degree of identity politics, but keeping a balance with it. In a vacuum, although personally I have zero interest and have never had any interest in white identitarianism, in part I will argue because I don't associate myself with white as an ethnicity so much as more precisely with Mormon as an ethnicity, but that's a tangent. But setting that discomfort aside, setting that aside, what I have seen when people try to do that sort of thing is that things like this have stable resting points. Every idea has a stable resting point. And so say when the alt-right does its thing, or when neo-reaction does its thing, or when the dissident right does its thing, my very strong impression of any of that sort of we just want to have this sort of transactional identity politics, whatever, we just want to be aware of hard truths, anything like that, is that the set point that these places congeal on is we are going to talk about nothing but race and IQ and also how much we hate black people all the time, forever, eternally. So I guess my question is, and I think you might be in a position to avoid this, but my question is, do you have an explicit awareness of that sort of thing and an explicit strategy to avoid it?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. And I'm very glad you asked that, because that's basically what brought down the alt-right and why any sort of movement like that is an inevitable trap. Because what happens is it starts off where you have a bunch of 130, 140 IQ guys who are just very disagreeable and who are willing to state those hard truths and who get ostracized because they're a little too autistic and they don't know how to navigate, the social rules of power or whatever. That they start congealing in some sort of spot, and they have all these really interesting ideas, and they create a great community. They create a lot of funny memes. Everything's amazing. And then it starts attracting people who are just misfits, because they're assholes, or because they're they might have that lack of social awareness, but they don't have any IQ to compensate for that. Or they're just bad people who get ostracized because they do bad things, or criminals or whatever. And that's inevitably what happens to any fringe movement. It happens on both the right and the left, but I'd say that it tends to happen more to whichever side is kind of out of power or whatever. And really it's the far right is obviously at least historically, it was kind of the lowest prestige thing after World War II. So that's where you got dumb, shitty people falling into skinhead movements or whatever. And that's what white nationalism 1.0 was. But the alt-right initially avoided that. And the problem was we didn't maintain any kind of elitism in terms of, because the thing is in terms of what the alt-right was actually achieving, everything achieved by the alt-right was really only by the elite cohort, by the elite subset of leaders and content creators who were mostly around in 2014, 2015, before the movement became popular. But as we picked up steam and we're attracting kind of more normie people, more temperamentally conservative people, more people from a more conservative background themselves, it just the discourse started lowering to a level where we weren't intellectually generative. We weren't interesting to elite liberals anymore. We weren't interesting to even, after a certain point, elite centrists. And it started getting to the point where I will give you a concession, Trace. There were some times when I did sometimes make content that was a little just more chuddish white nationalist, just because I wanted to give myself rhetorical space to say something that was more provocative, right? To like head the community in a right direction in another way. And sometimes to do that, like you do have to just make people, you have to pander to the base a little bit. As an artist, you're always struggling, especially a propagandist, right? Like you're always struggling between the desire to like say something provocative and to sort of like push people in a direction that's a bit more esoteric, right? But like you think is ultimately right, but just it's not very populist. And then on the other hand, the desire to for people to think that you're not some sort of sellout or you're not some sort of I don't know, that you're not being too like self-indulgent. Like it's a very heavy thing, right? That you're always having to struggle with. But I do agree with you. Like I think that like that I personally in my art did pander too much to the retards who were coming into the movement because I liked the popularity. I liked the attention. And that's another thing is that like whenever you get someone who becomes a big name in a movement, like a big part of that's a social aspect. And I even said the real ethno state was the friends we made along the way. Like for me, the biggest part of the alt-right was it's the same reason a lot of rationalists probably love the Mod or love, you know, Scott Alexander's blog. It's finding a community of high IQ people who you can talk to who just push back on your ideas in interesting ways, who have diverse perspectives, who are willing to say things that other people, who are willing to say that the fucking emperor has no clothes, right? And that's something that the alt-right had in spades in 2015, and that's why I became and why I'm still defensive of it, right? But then the problem is, when you're really smart publicly, you get a lot of people who start like blowing smoke up your ass, and you know you'll get groupies, you know you'll get all this shit, and then it makes it easy for you to just like want to optimize for that, especially as a young man who's like, especially if you're kind of immature and you don't have, I don't know, you're looking for that to be your identity, right? And it can lead you into some bad steps. And I think a lot of leaders in the alt-right sort of like let their own discourse, they let their own like rhetorical style degrade to match the lowest common denominator because they enjoyed that. And sometimes it was even a subconscious thing. They probably didn't even realize it was happening. So my plan to avoid that is by being like explicitly elitist and whenever I feel like I'm going too far down one road, I tend to like radically veer in the opposite direction and like attack that group or something. You know what I mean? Like what I mean by that is recently I've come out like very strongly against conservatives and MAGA. I've done the kind of Richard Hanania thing, right? I'm basically like a lot of my material on Substack is directly attacking MAGA conservatives, even to some extent white nationalists, just like pointing out the holes in the worldview and the things that I think are problematic. Like to me, seeking truth and pointing out, like breaking up the circle jerk is like my highest goal, right? I hate it when people start agreeing and people just start like fucking patting each other on the back too much. And that's why I always appreciate a Richard Spencer, because he never really leaned into that as a leader. Like he did try to promote, you know, some degree of debate, and he did try to say uncomfortable things. Now, at a certain point, the movement just got too big and too, you know, even he couldn't control it anymore. But, you know, I think that's the most important thing is that as a leader, you have to make sure that you can't like rest on your laurels. You can't just like enjoy the attention and the groupies and the press, you know, whatever. You have to like, it has to remain about the ideas. And that's why, like, I think I'm more capable of being a leader now than I was all those years ago, because at the time I was an incel neat, you know, like I was using the movement to like, I don't know, like give me like self-esteem. Whereas these days I have plenty of self-esteem outside the movement. I'm using the movement as an opportunity to like talk to interesting people and develop my ideas. And it's still very kind of incoherent at this point. I don't really know where it's leading, but I'm talking to like Brahmin Indians and Black nationalists and feminists and people of all these different diverse worldviews, because I want to refine my own ideas. And I want like an iron honing iron approach to discourse. That's why I'm here talking to you guys right now. You know, I want there to be constant pushback and constant conflict, because one of the reasons I'm still right wing is because I believe conflict and discord and I don't know, like I have an immense respect for just fighting. I think, and it's probably my like Scotch Irish blood or whatever. I think that like it's in fighting and conflict and strife that you bring out the best in people. And that's why I do believe in elite immigration, is because I want to compete with Jews. You know, I love competing with Jews. I love competing with Protestants. And I find that like behind closed doors, you're fine with people making fun of them and doing that. They'll make fun of you. It'll all just be, you know, they don't want a bunch of like angry rednecks coming down on them with pitchforks, but they're fine with like some like nerdy white guy like making anti-Semitic jokes in private. That's the sort of environment I like, you know? And it's like Rome. Like Rome was a very diverse society, but it was also very racist, you know? So, I mean, it's like, that's the sort of environment I want, is the constant conflict, because that's what brews the real Faustian spirit. And that's what lets white people become exceptional.
So Richard Spencer is a great example of the point that I was trying to make. Are you familiar with the leaked audio that Milo Yiannopoulos put out? Like,
Spencer, oh, the one where he was saying, like, that was him just being a theater kid. Like, look, like,
okay,
like,
I'm going to drop it in here and just refresh your memory.
Like, this is never over. No. I win. They fucking lose. That's how the fucking kites! They get ruled by people like me! Little fucking octoroons! I fucking, my ancestors fucking enslaved those pieces of fucking shit!
We're gonna win.
I rule the fucking world! Those pieces of shit get ruled by people like me! They look up and see a face like mine looking down at them! That's how the fucking world works!
You know, it was right after Charlottesville. He said, little fucking kikes, they get ruled by people like me. Little fucking octoroons, my ancestors fucking enslaved those little pieces of fucking shit. I don't know what he's going for, okay? And this is the issue. Like, when he's presenting himself, it's like, oh, I'm this respectable person that has, like, this very straight-laced haircut and just, like, wants a peaceful separation for the white race. I don't believe him. Because he's putting up, he clearly is trying to like hide his genuine or potentially genuine opinions by saying, I just want to be on top. I'm a white guy. I don't feel like falling behind. I want to rule other races. That's what I really want to do. But I'm going to play this bullshit game and make people think that I'm much more respectable than I actually am.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is like white guys tend to end up on top anyway when there is multiculturalism, right? So it's like it's kind of stupid to oppose it because it makes white people better to when you have multiculturalism. Anyway,
I guess if you're already scaled, right? If you're a mediocre white guy and you just want to ride the coattails of your racial category, this is the right pathway for you.
The funny thing is, if you are a skilled white guy, especially if you, I don't know, if you're articulate and have a deep voice, people will just like hand you power, right? It's like you'll naturally rise. It's just silly to see white nationalists opposing multiculturalism for that. It's kind of stupid. Anyway, what I'd say about Richard Spencer is that you can't judge anybody by what they say in like a very stressful situation that they didn't know was being recorded. No, like, look, we all say shit. Like, look, have you never like said a bunch of crazy, like aggressive shit, like during a fight with your girlfriend or like in some like moment? I don't know. Like I'll say like random shit like that all the time.
The thing I'll grant you is that you can't judge people by any particular instance, but it doesn't mean that the evidence is worthless.
Well, hold on. You can judge people by any particular instance. You can't condemn them entirely based on any.
I'm saying you can't do it conclusively. I'm saying every piece of evidence has some weight.
Right. Like someone who snaps, like people, the ways. So this is something I say about ideologies. The ways an ideology goes wrong, you can see predicted in the ways their founding texts are written, the ways their founding are laid out, the seeds of their errors are laid out where you see them go wrong along the distance. You can look back and be like, oh, they actually, this is the reason it went wrong in that way in particular. It's tied to this. And I think likewise, when someone snaps, and yes, most people snap at some point. When someone snaps, the way in which they snap, the things they say during snapping and everything reflect true and clear things about them. They snap in different ways than other people would snap.
I guess I don't see anything about the thing Richard Spencer said that like goes against his general. I mean, like, yeah, it's kind of.
Well, that's
like,
that's kind of my point, right?
Right.
Well, look, I mean, he does want to rule, but like, I don't think. Look, I think the problem with wanting to rule is if you're not direct about it. Like, I'm direct about wanting to rule. Yeah, like, I do think guys like me should be in charge of things, but, like, I'll do it well, and I'll do it in a way that, like, makes everyone happier, right?
So, I mean, actually, this goes back to, I did think you were saying some pretty interesting things in your conception of here's how to keep it a healthy movement, so forth, here's how your project can be good. And, you know, I agree with you. Like, you're right. The reason I hung out in the Mott, the reason I hung out around the rationalist community, the reason I do the things I do in the spaces I do them is because I like talking with smart, interesting people about things that I care about. And you need to do a certain set of things to attract those people. Mm-hmm. At the same time, that's only so much circle jerking, as it were, if it's not creating a healthy culture more broadly. That is, that ultimately, I don't know that you can dismiss regular people or what have you, the people who end up getting attracted to something on the margins. And people will always, you know, people like smart, interesting people doing cool things. They will always like smart, interesting people doing cool things. They have always liked smart, interesting people doing cool things. And so a lot of people will, and I would say should be, attracted to any group of smart, interesting people doing cool things on the periphery, on the margins. The question is, and I think ultimately the project for any movement is, what sort of culture can be transmitted? Be like, if you want to have elites, what sort of culture lower down are those elites encouraging? What sort of project are those elites encouraging? And so this is one of my deep frustrations with the distant right, with that whole sphere, is that the cultures that any elites among them are encouraging, and they have some very smart people, the culture of that is this very grimy, low culture.
So I can explain why that is. So I think that in 2010 to 2014, the energy on the sort of dissident right, whatever, was on YouTube. And YouTube, I think it sort of encouraged, like there were like, you know, shitty trolls in the comments, but like the fact that you had to sit down and make a video, it did encourage like a more intellectual, more thoughtful kind of person. And then I think what happened was it moved to, you know, TRS and 4chan and Twitter, and it, especially in an anonymous environment like 4chan, it just like, that does encourage very lowest common denominator because like it's very shitposty, right? And even Twitter, I mean, like the character limit, the fact that it was mostly pseudonymous, like it does just, it degrades the quality of the discourse. I think that nowadays a lot of the energy is on Substack, and Substack inherently is just like much bigger brain, right? It's like inherently elitist, and it allows you to like, what's really interesting is that like, there's almost like a lower potential for just celebrity, because like I feel like on Twitter and on YouTube, it's almost like it's ruled by the high and the low, right? Like you can become this like hyper celebrity, but then you can also, you know, just be this like stupid shit poster, and then the celebrities tend to like pander to the shit posters. Whereas I feel like on Substack, it's more sort of like middle class in a sense, where it's like it's very easy for content creators and their you know, like their fans to engage on kind of more of an equal footing. And then I find that it's the sort of person I talk to in my Substack comment section, like they're very eager to like come on my podcast. Right. Like I've gotten like a lot of like really interesting commenters who, you know, like Indian Brahmins or black nationalists or feminists who like they start off as commenters on my essays. And they always say something like, oh, you know, I love it when to talk to other people who like push back and disagree with their own side. Right. And what I want to do is create a community that's entirely of people who are like the sort of people who push back on their own side, the sort of people who like to break up the circle jerks, the sort of people who get really uncomfortable when everyone is agreeing too much. Right. Because it's that point in any movement when everyone starts agreeing too much that you lose some kind of vitality, and it becomes like ruled by retards who just like send you down into the gutter, right? Like that happens like over and over again in any kind of movement. I'm sure like there are black people who would say the same thing happened to Black Lives Matter, right? I'm sure there's like plenty of feminists who would say the same thing happened with like Slow Walk or the Pussy Hat March, or, you know, whatever it was. Like it just, every movement inherently has like that sort of cycle. And I'm not interested in being a movement at this point. I've sort of thought about it. I used that language in some of my earlier posts, but again, like I'm on a journey. So, you know, I was sort of figuring out what I really want to do. And I think I don't want to create a movement. I want to create like an intellectual space that it does two things. One, it sort of like bridges white nationalists back into the mainstream discourse and simultaneously de-radicalizes white nationalists, but also gives them an ability to rehabilitate themselves and become public intellectuals again, like on the right wing without humiliating themselves or do like showing their belly, right? But like at the same time, giving them that ability to de-radicalize and talk to people of different perspectives. And I think that right now, like by talking to both white nationalists who, you know, used to be allies of mine and are still my friends, like in the movement, and then at the same time talking to nationalists of other perspectives, and you know, like black nationalists or even just like libertarian ANCAPs who of like Brahmin descent, right? I think I can create that space where we can all sort of like hate each other less, right? I think that's the most important thing. Is I want us to all be able to like talk about our ideas and like view each other as one. I like create a community of like smart people who just value the fact that we're, you know, not prone to circle jerking. The fact that we are willing to discuss big ideas and we can push back on each other without getting into stupid fights. Like that should be the ultimate source of in-grouping, right?
So and then, coordinating around ideas is admirable. That seems to make sense. But coordinating, I guess, around group identity, there seems to be an inherent failure point for this type of community building because, okay, you'll grant that when you look at white people, there's a range of skill. Right? There's some elites, there's some retards, as you put it. You don't expect everyone to be on the same level, right?
Of course.
So that's one of the issues that I don't understand. Why does it become a salient characteristic? Whether someone is white tells right. you only something as, I guess, like from a Bayesian prediction. Like, oh, you're more likely to do this, you're more likely to do this, you're less likely to do this. Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily tell you anything conclusive about the individual themselves, right?
But people rely on heuristics to like get through the world. Like you can't have this like autistic 160 IQ, like big brain, hyper accurate mentality about everything, or you're gonna fall behind like dumb normies who just use simplifying like bigoted heuristics to like.
No, that's fine. Heuristics are fine, but the issue is that when you center a group, when you center a community around group identity that has only tangential effects downstream, you lose the vetting process that gets you the elite.
Okay. Yes. Fair. And I think there was too much of, yeah. And this is something I pushed back on at the time. I was like, hey, like, I don't think we should be letting in like people with like swastika tattoos on their foreheads, you know, because I it was always a private position. Right. And I know
it doesn't even have to be that, like, you're not going to let in like my clients, like my white meth addict client that's homeless, right, into your movement. You don't want him in the movement, right?
Right. Yes.
So, but yeah. You don't, if your qualification is you're white, what's your argument for like kicking men out of the movement?
The reason that we like had that as the basis of our identity is that's the most like salient point we were being attacked on. We were being attacked as white people. So it made sense to defend ourselves as white people. So like it would have been weird, you know, like there were like a million BuzzFeed articles coming out a day about how like it was a good thing white people were going to be a minority. Like it just like that's what made sense. Now in the current ecology, it doesn't. Right. And that's why I'm no longer a white nationalist. Like I care about other things a lot more. I care about like the technology of like infinite pleasure. Like I'm worried that like, you know, Sidney Sweeney blowjob simulator.
That's fair. And I admire like how introspective you are. But my question still stands, like, how do you screen for people if it's based off of this inherent characteristic?
Yeah. That only has are you willing to effects? Make content that's become like sort of my own heuristic. Number one, if you go on Substack and you have a Substack account where you make like thoughtful comments, then you probably are already at least like 115 IQ, right? Like that.
But I'm going back to, I guess, like making any movement based on white identity.
Well, yeah, I'm not interested in making a movement anymore. And I agree with you.
I understand that. And I'm not trying to imply that you're being dishonest about that. But to me, this is the inherent failure point of any movement that is based off of an inherent identity. And on the flip side, you will see the same dynamics play out with what would be called the wokeness, where identity is the only thing that matters to some people. They'll say, oh, you should only listen to trans voices, or you should listen to people of color. They don't really give a shit about the underlying merit of the individual as long as they fit the label. So to me, that's the same failure point on both sides.
I agree. I don't think we have any disagreement here.
Okay. But all right.
Why are you frustrated? I want to explore that.
Yeah. So to me, I just don't see why anyone would care about that particular label? Why would they want to build on something further with just that particular label? And I know you said you abandoned it. I believe you're being honest about that, but I don't know why you cared otherwise. I know you said, well, the white identity felt attacked, but then what do you do with that afterwards? I want to understand that mentality better.
Because I mean, okay. So again, like I want to put you in the mind of like an insecure, like 23 year old, like neat incel. I guess I wasn't neat. I was in college, but I thought of myself as a neat, I guess. And you know, like I just, in my college courses, there'd always be some like, you know, like chubby Hispanic girl who talked about how much she like hated white people and about like how white people were oppressors. And when you're in that environment, like you'll just get negatively polarized. It'll be like, well, fuck you. I'm proud to be white.
Sure. Okay.
And you know,
I understand. Here's what I'll grant. I understand why someone would react that way. I understand why that would be, I guess, like a reflex to it. I don't understand how it would be constructive. And the one, I don't know if it's associated with the alt-right, but the sticker that said like, it's okay to be white. I thought that was a brilliant form of marketing because it inherently put any criticism, like it made them look idiotic when they get mad at seeing a sticker that was as banal.
I loved it's okay to be white. That should have been the direction of the movement in 2017, 2018. Like we should have leaned into shit like that, just finding little propaganda campaigns like that. But like people were retarded and they wanted to do their stupid marches. But no, I agree with you. Like that's the thing is we should have de-radicalized after Trump took power and become about stuff like that, just like going after anti-whites.
Well, I don't know if you can just like do a hard turn already de-radicalized yourself into counterproductive anti.
No, I agree. Like the movement basically had to burn out in the way it did, and it's sad because I mean, I don't know. Like nobody at the time, like there was too much of an appetite. It felt like we had momentum, and it felt like I don't know. Like it felt like it would have been like cowardice. Like
well, momentum to do what?
To fight back against people who were trying to humiliate us and people who had been like mocking us and like attacking us for years. I mean, sure, again, like you say it's not constructive, but again, in the mind of an early 20s guy who was this filled with testosterone, full of resentment, full of whatever, it's like nothing's going to be constructive. You just have this Sturm und Drang that you need to manipulate with art or with, you know, arguments or whatever you can do. But like you have to appeal to the Sturm und Drang. You can't talk about like what's constructive because to a young man, like they don't give a fuck about constructive. They like the idea of something that'll give them money or give them pussy. That's why Andrew Tate is popular. But when it comes to like building a glorious civilization, like most guys are not going to like think about constructive or altruism or anything like that, probably until like their late 20s at least. I mean, it's just not how people are, you know?
Well, my argument would be that the movement was doomed to fail because it centered around an irrelevant group identity. It doesn't tell you exactly, it's not that helpful in telling you about the individuals that joined a movement if it's just like checking a box, like, are you white, yes or no?
Again, it's not salient anymore, but it was at the time because we were under such attack. And I consider it to have been successful because that's no longer the case. Like, it feels much easier to be, like, I don't know, a white guy in 2024 than it did in 2014.
I think I would just ask for, I guess, what then what? So, to go back on your soft white nationalism, you list several things. The things I'll grant you that are well-grounded with regards to the interests and rights of white people would be immigration and affirmative action, but only because the legality, the policy itself is based off of the definition of race and ethnicity. So when affirmative action asks you, are you white, are you Asian, are you black, that's inherently explicitly going to be a race-based policy. But when you say something like protecting whites from crimes committed by other races, I don't, what does that mean? Like, are you talking about white enclaves?
Yeah, and interracial rape, for instance. Like, there's like tens of thousands of instances of black men raping white women every year, whereas the opposite, like,
doesn't really happen. So, how does that look different from just protecting against rape in general?
Because I think oftentimes it is racially motivated. I think there is like a sense of like black men wanting to get back at the white man by raping his woman. And like, I think that like you can't.
How would you protect against that? When you say protecting whites from crimes committed by other races, how does that look different from just protecting against crimes?
I would just say a harsher carceral state in general. Things like stop and frisk.
A harsher carceral state for black people or just in general?
No, for everybody. But it's going to have, like, obviously things have, like, look, the way things trickle down in practice, it's always. Right now, you've seen FBI crime statistics. Well, hold on. You're a defense attorney, right?
Yes.
I mean, that probably shapes your worldview.
in some ways, yes. But I'm trying to understand, like, what does a policy of protecting whites from crimes committed by other races, how does that look different from just protecting against crime?
In practice, all you'd have to do is crack down on crime more harshly generally, and it would mostly be black crime that you're containing.
Okay, but... So it doesn't look any different, right?
It doesn't, but the reason you can't do that is because of pro-black like religion, basically, in America. We have this religious political instinct. And I write about this in my essay, The Metapolitics of Black-White Conflict. You know my basic theory. Like, we have this like cycle in American history that, where we alternate between like sort of like worshiping or fetishizing black people and like desperately trying to like bring them up to like the white standard. And then sometimes there's a very like vicious sort of crackdown on black people, right? Like, because we feel like they took us for granted, they took advantage of our liberalism or whatever, and then we'll either ignore them or we'll have a certain kind of contempt for them. I think that I actually support reparations because I think that that would be a way of moving away from that cycle. And I want to give white people the sort of mental flexibility to say, okay, you know, I'm just going to advocate for white interests. Like, we don't need to do this anymore. And the way you do that is by giving each black person about $250,000 paid out as an annuity. And I think it would last about 80 years. It would be like 4% of our federal budget. I did the calculations. I don't think it would be that onerous from a fiscal perspective, but I think it could just give white people, especially particularly like squishy white women, like not super liberal white women, but kind of like moderate. I think those are the ones you need to target because those are the ones who like are that critical mass. Right. Like at the beginning of Black Lives Matter, like when you get the squishy, moderate white woman who starts like, you know, pressuring everybody to put the stupid black rectangle on her Instagram, that's when these things go too far. So I want to give that sort of person because a lot of white nationalists say, oh, this is crazy. You give them an inch, you're going to take a mile. I don't agree with that. I want to make it as uncomfortable and as annoying for white people as possible. That way they'll have the mental flexibility to say, OK, I can advocate for white interests. And this is the brilliant thing about reparations. I want Ron DeSantis to run on this in his 2028 campaign. I want him to go up on a Republican debate stage and say, I'm supporting reparations for black people because it'll be good for white people. Right now, Republicans dog whistle all the time, but they never talk about white people or white interests or anything like that. But I think this is like brilliant triangulation, because if you can come out for reparations, no one's going to call you a racist. But then enables you to talk about white interests.
Your position on reparations is clearly race-based. And so I grant that part. So going back, I'm going to ask the question about crime. If protecting whites from crimes committed by other races doesn't look any different from just protecting against crime, why would you want to advocate the former rather than the later?
Because the reason you can't have harsh anti-crime policies in general is because of a liberal instinct towards black people.
But do you think that helps when we... So let me see if I understand. You're saying that when you say we need to crack down on crime, the liberal response is, no, that's racist. So your response is, we need to protect whites from crimes committed by other races. Do you think that is going to be received better?
I think that the way you got to square the circle by addressing the black white issue in a way that like conservatives aren't willing to do, right? Conservatives, the only way they address
how it does the latter? I just don't understand how making it explicitly about protecting white people. How does that help?
Because
politically?
You're thinking of things in very rationalist terms, where everything is about like.
No, I'm saying how does it help politically?
Because you have to look at the subtext of the issue, which is that, like, if you do start cracking down on crime really aggressively, you're going to end up with massive quantities of black men in prison, and liberals aren't comfortable with that. So you need to figure out what's the underlying cause of the issue, and that's why I support
reparations. How do you make them comfortable?
Reparations.
Okay, so, you don't have to talk about it as...
If you don't, then no one takes you seriously.
Well, when you're talking to liberals, if the concern is, like, getting liberals on board... What do you think is more effective, saying we need to crack down on crime or we need to protect white people from black people?
That's not what I say. What I say when talking to a liberal is we need to support reparations.
Right, but between those two options, like this goes back to my question. This seems to be like an inherent failure point. When you make it about white people, you don't gain anything.
Make it about white people when you're talking to Republicans. When you're talking to liberals, you talk about reparations. You talk about how the black man deserves his 40 acres and a mule, right? And I calculated the cost. It's about $250,000. So you give him that.
If you're so clearly tailoring your message to different audiences, though, that in itself presents a weak point in the sense of people know when you're pandering to them.
No. Well, yeah, I'm explicit about that. I'll tell black people I'm pandering to them. I'll tell white nationalists I'm pandering to them. I'll tell liberals, I'll tell you guys I'm pandering to. I'm talking about things in a much more rationalist way than I normally do because I'm pandering to you. Pandering is just social intelligence, right? But the thing is, like, you have to be explicitly transactional, explicitly selfish. You can't pretend that, like, I'll tell both liberals, white nationalists, whoever, I'm doing my policies because it benefits me, right? And I'm saying, here's what's in it for you. You have to be explicit.
That's fine. I don't think that's an issue. I'm trying to, I guess, just understand the effectiveness because I'm reading through. I tried to figure out what policies would flow downstream of being a soft white nationalist.
Yeah.
And I just don't. I don't understand how this fits. How it advances the cause. The other one you mentioned is like securing free speech while spreading a general understanding of HBD, which is human biodiversity and interracial crime rates. What does that get you?
Well, okay. So that's the thing. If people understand that black criminality is just massively worse than of other races, then I think they will adopt different perspectives on things. Like it sort of just happens downstream. It's just a natural psychological effect of that. And I think there actually is a lot of ignorance as to the massive disparities in crime rates. Right.
I agree. There's a lot of ignorance, but there's also, I don't adopt these explanations, but there's ways that you can convince a liberal that's afraid of thinking racist thoughts that, whatever discrepancies in criminality, they're not necessarily a result of genetic differences, or they're just actually the result of racial institutional racism, right?
Yeah.
Like, for example, you could say, oh, well, the reason crime rates in the black communities are higher is because their education system is fucked up. They're more likely to live next to pollution.
Yeah, but that's an anti-white narrative. I don't want to give an anti-white narrative credence because I don't think it's due to
Okay, but if I don't see how that's an anti-white credence, it doesn't say anything about white people. It just provides like other explanations to keep like the liberals happy so that they can be on board.
I'd rather keep them happy by just giving black people money. And I think black people would prefer that. I think a lot of black people resent the paternalistic liberal mentality. If you look at my second podcast guest, she finds like liberal white people more racist than conservative white people. And she loved the fact that I was so honest and direct with her. I think most black people would. I think what black people resent isn't even like white in-group preference. It's how most white people lie about their in-group preferences and will dog whistle or will like say, you know, talk out of the side of their mouth. Like the funny thing is like, yeah, I do pander to people, but that's just transactional coalitional politics. It's not like I'll be very honest about having an in-group preference for white people. But like, I'm not hateful, you know.
I'm not describing this as pandering. Trace, does this make sense to you?
I get where he's coming from with his explanation.
Okay, for me, this is an example of just the failure point of centering around group identity. When you structure policies on that, you turn off the people outside of the group, and I don't know what you gain for the people inside the group.
Well, okay,
because I don't think you can.
I won't talk about like. Okay, so when you talk about crime, I won't say crime in terms of white people. I would actually say the difficult thing is that, like Hanania actually wrote a great article about this. Did you read that about how like America doesn't have like a racial problem? It's a black nationalism problem.
Yes, I like that a lot.
Yeah, I do too. Well, I think the issue with crime isn't like non-whites. And I think white nationalists make the issue, like people talked about like associating immigration with crime. Like, I think that's kind of stupid because like our crime problem isn't like immigrants, right? And I like push back on other white nationalists when they still lean into that because that's a stupid narrative. Well, it is like a black inner city problem. And I think we have to deal with that empathetically. And the way to do that is with reparations. So that's how I like.
Sure, I understand that. That's like your political advantage, and I'm sorry for hammering on this. I just don't understand like who it benefits to structure it as explicitly as like a group identity campaign. Do you like when you're talking to white people in general?
Yeah.
Do you, when you say, "Hey, we need to bring down crime," do you expect like less interest than if you were to say, "Hey, we need to protect white people from black people"?
I think that the problem is that when you pretend it's not a racial issue, people realize
you're I'm not being... pretending it's not a racial issue. I'm trying to like make it as broadly appealing as possible. I'm not cutting out anything. I'm just saying we need to reduce crime.
But
like that's all, right?
Yeah. I think that like the salience of crime is a racial issue though.
Right. So I will step in to, I guess, what I hear from Walt, one thing I hear from Walt is the idea that I think this is, say, the Rufo approach to ending affirmative action or whatever. And he'll say, like, we should end affirmative action and then have merit-based policies and let the best person win and everything. And the massive unstated subtext of that is if you end affirmative action in this way and if you have Rufo's preferred policies, then the racial composition at universities will dramatically change. And people will dance around that a little bit and be like, well, we don't actually mean that exactly. Mm-hmm. I think what Walt is critiquing, if I'm understanding him correctly, is that sort of dancing around, that sort of attitude of, I am going to advocate for things that I know will have this very specific effect, and I know people will object to this specific effect, and will object in these very specific terms to this effect, but I do not want to address this effect head on at all, and so I'm just going to skirt that out towards the edge of consciousness and not touch that.
Thank you. That was perfect. That was perfect, Trace. Yes.
How would you map that out to the crime discussion that we were just having?
Yeah, no. So with the crime discussion, absolutely. The question is, with crime, when you say, oh, we want to reduce crime rates, the subtext is, for some of these people who are saying it, that not even the subtext, the result will be that a lot more black people would go to jail under, say, this very hard, tough on crime, toss lots of people in jail.
It's always been that way. It's always been like tough on crime has always been massively anti-black, whether it's stop and frisk, whether it's the drug war, whether it's even lynching. I mean, like this is just a thing that has really bad connotations to like the white liberal mind. And that's what I'm worried about white liberals more than I am actual black people. Because black people, they're probably just going to vote, you know, they're going to give Democrats Saddam Hussein margins no matter what. But what matters is like white liberal, like or moderate women kind of. I'm thinking of how do you secure their vote for conservatives like going forward? And the way you do that is to make the argument that that black people have been, you know, poorly treated. Like, you have to give them an argument, no credibility whatsoever. This is a religious fixation that has to be broken with.
So I'm still trying to understand how it maps because someone could hold the position like, I actually don't care about crime. I want to see more black people in prison. They wouldn't be in favor of those are the people that wouldn't be in favor of a policy of just reducing crime in general.
Those people don't really exist. You have a few like sadists on the margins, sure. But like what I'm saying is I do think that the majority here's what I'll tell you. The majority of Republicans do have soft white nationalist beliefs right now, number one. Number two, the majority of Republicans do care about crime and they care about black crime specifically, but they don't say that. They dog whistle. And I think that dog whistling is very annoying to minorities and especially to black people. And it makes their in-group preference seem worse than it is. And it makes them seem just less honorable than they really are. If you talk about like needing to restrain criminality in more explicit terms, but you also offer black people something in a transactional way, I think that's the key to squaring the circle on this issue.
Well, I'm failing to understand why framing it explicitly as a race in racial terms, how did that advances the cause?
Because number one, it makes black people think that you're dealing with them in good faith.
When you say protect whites from crimes committed by other races?
That's not what I say.
I was asking about the crime question.
I know. I'm talking about, I would say like black criminality is a problem. I do think we need to be explicit about that. And okay. Okay, if I'm talking to like if I'm talking like a white nationalist, I might talk about like, yeah, like crimes against whites or something, like go in another direction. But that's the only time I would say that.
I have an analogy, without endorsing Walt's position here, I have an analogy to conversation that I recently had, where someone was talking about Matt Walsh's position to me and was trying to explain to me when I was saying, you know, Matt Walsh kind of wants trans people to disappear. And he was saying, no, if you look at it, he really cares about gender dysphoric kids and he just wants them to have the right sort of treatment. And if you look at it, he's not saying this, he's not saying this. He's just kind of, and if you look at it, and he's just trying to be very reasonable and very polite about Matt Walsh's position and everything. Whereas I know if Matt Walsh was speaking to me directly, you know, he would just say, basically, you're a freak, you're a pervert, screw off, I'm your enemy. Right. And there's a much more directness in Matt Walsh's version of that. And so I think what I hear from Waltzing is basically make the subtext explicit text, not necessarily centering the subtext even all the time, but make it clear to people that the things they know that you have in mind with it, that yes, you do have those things in mind with it, but here's why you can make that useful. And I think there is merit to being direct about that instead of dancing around it.
Because the subtext is always superior than when it's text. Because usually when something is left to subtext, people will build it up in their minds in a much more hysterical and paranoid way than your intentions actually are. And I'll give you a great example of this from the other side. You know, like I used to see all of these like anti-white, like hysterical articles from mostly Jewish journalists back in like 2014, 2015. And that made me more anti-Semitic. And when I would see someone like Matt Iglesias or Noah Smith, or I don't know, like any of those like writers, I was sort of prejudiced against them. And I would read things they would say as like anti-white. Or Ezra Klein, you know, another great example, as anti-white, when like really, like if you know, looking at them now, like those people are kind of like pro-white voices in the Democratic coalition, right? So I mean, I don't know. It's like when you make things more explicit, as they have done, right? As like a lot of like people like Matt Iglesias, Noah Smith, like they've come out against like anti-white identity politics in the years since, and I think that's had a massively positive effect on the discourse. I think similarly, Republicans need to be more explicit about their own in-group identity. And they need to. It needs to just be destigmatized. It needs to be a thing that's like less like scary or fashy or we have to make it just like an ordinary. Like I want like the white in-group preference among Republicans to be the same way people talk about like old black people in South Carolina, right? It's just like a transactional, just like normal aspect of politics.
So here's my last attempt, and we can move on to something else. Here's how I would phrase the crime question. If you say that the racial sadists don't exist or they're not, I guess, material enough to matter, the way I would frame it is say, okay, we need to crack down on crime. I acknowledge that blacks commit crimes at a higher rate than any other racial group. And I acknowledge that cracking down on crime, it will increase the incarceration rate for black people.
Yes.
There's nothing, I'm not omitting anything, right?
I think that you're phrasing it in a very sort of rationalist way. And I'm sort of more artistically minded, and I would try to like, you know, like play up different aspects of it without being insincere. But you're getting to the meat of it. Yes.
Okay. So my last attempt at this question, if I said we need to protect or we need to crack down on black criminality, the first thing that comes to mind is how does that look different from just cracking down on blacks in general? Because then I start thinking, okay, do you want to have lower rates? What is it like higher? Policing in black neighborhoods specifically, not because they're high crime, but because they're black. So you would go to like the rich Atlanta suburbs that have black people in it. Do you want to have like lower evidentiary standards for black defendants? Like, I just don't understand what that looks like.
What I mean is, you know, there's stuff like police officers are given training, right? Specifically to be like less aggressive to black people. Like, I mean, getting rid of stuff like that. But again, I'm an artist. So I think about things like when it comes to propaganda, what's a good symbolism thing? I would create a militia of black men. I would pay them an enormous amount of money to police their own communities and be incredibly hostile to like antisocial forces. I would pay just like a normal, like 28-year-old black guy, like 150 grand a year to just go beat the shit out of criminals. And I think that would be a great propaganda victory for the right. Now, how you actually do that in practice, you know, I'll leave that to the nerds to figure out. But like stuff like that, like those are the sort of like propaganda, you know, things I would do in order to make this something that's not like anti-black, but like addresses the very racial, you know, aspect of this.
Okay.
So one thing that I'll say that this idea of, well, why can't they just make this, you know, soft white nationalism explicit? I think for a lot of people, a lot of liberals and centrists, including me, the very natural answer to why not make this sort of soft white nationalism explicit is, well, let's look at what's happened throughout history when people have made this sort of white nationalism, soft white nationalism explicit, and let's look at the ways that it has very directly hurt people, very directly harmed people, so forth. And so when you're talking about, you know, we can do things like reparations and everything, we can get people on board for this sort of transactional stuff, reparations, what have you. My reaction to that is, you know, it's a really cool theory. It's a really neat idea. Do you really think people are going to spring for that? Like, do you really?
Yeah.
Think that you could get the Trump coalition to spring for reparations? And if you did, do you think that you could do it in such a way that it would pull everyone together in this kumbaya moment? Has politics ever a single time in history worked that way?
Not in the long term, but I think if someone like Ron DeSantis had someone like me as his like propaganda minister, right, or as his campaign manager, I think he could do it. Let me tell you how you do it. You frame reparations as a white nationalist policy. Right. You go on the Republican debate stage and you get far to the right of everybody else and you call them anti-white because they won't say the word white people. They won't advocate for white interests. But nobody will call you a racist because you're supporting reparations. It would look weird. You get a bunch of black guys on TikTok like saying, vote for Ron DeSantis. He's going to give us the bag. Right. Meanwhile, you'll run against like Vivek Ramaswamy and like you'll say you're trying to curry favor with voters in Iowa by saying you're a monotheist. Right. You do a little like. A few things like that, be kind of like mildly racist against some of your opponents. You say that Tim Scott would be running a Chick-fil-A if he were white. You know, you say things like that. You get really aggressive against your opponents. You run far to the right, but at the same time, you're supporting reparations. So it's like, well, like it confuses the media. It makes it very hard for CNN to just paint you as a fascist or whatever. And then so you can easily, you know, by being very aggressive, because that's what Republicans expect. They respect power. Right. That's why Trump wins, is because he just like dominates. He just rubs his balls on everyone's face. Hanania famously wrote that DeSantis should have challenged Trump to a boxing match. And I think honestly, or he should have just called his wife a whore or something. That's the only way that you could beat Trump. Like you need to dominate him. And you know, nobody can do that right now. Nobody has the gravitas. So Trump is just dominant. But I think DeSantis could be in a position to do what I'm saying. Again, it's a crazy idea, but crazier things have been done. And I think that if he wins, then as he goes to the center, like he shouldn't like pivot to the center by being really cucky, but he should just make a lot of inroads to black. He should just like directly tell black people, I'm going to give you money. Right. And then you'll inevitably have this tension between like old black people and young people, where old black people are very like, you know, like loyal to the Democrat Party. And they're going to be like warning the young black people against making a deal with the devil. But I think you'll have a bunch of like young entrepreneurial black people kind of like starting to get interested in like Candace Owens style talking points and becoming just like, yeah, like, you know, like I don't mind when black people or when white people have this transactional approach to policy, they're actually going to give me something unlike the rest of you. So yeah, I'll vote DeSantis. Fuck it. Why not? Right. And I think that's all you need. If you can gut the black vote for Democrats in Philadelphia and Detroit, like you won. Right. And that's how DeSantis will win under this policy. He just needs to get a bunch of young black people, you know, to break off. If he gets like, and I don't think he'll even get 50% of the black vote. If he gets like 40, if he gets 30, that'll be enough. It'll just destroy the Democrat margins. The Democrats need Saddam margins among black people to win. Now, I think that in practice, as this is paid out over the years, as reparations, you know, continue, like you're gonna find instances where, and this was another aspect of the policy. I think that you should only give out reparations conditional on like not getting any felony convictions. And if you get a misdemeanor conviction, it's taken away for like, it's frozen. Your account is like frozen for like a year or something. So if you do this, you can also use reparations to control black criminality. Yeah, I should have mentioned that earlier. I totally forgot about that aspect of the policy, but that would have been very salient to our discussion a little bit earlier. But yeah, no, I think reparations is how you restrict black criminality. And then what's going to happen though is the Democrats will find some like cause célèbre. They'll find some like, you know, black guy, like some 19-year-old who gets his reparations frozen because of a marijuana conviction. And then like it'll turn black people against Republicans and, you know, it'll go back to more or less the way things were. However, the crucial change is that you'll get like those squishy moderate white women who will forevermore have a much higher sense of like racial identity, and they'll be much less likely to like, you know, cuck out and support like the next Black Lives Matter or whatever. So this is how I think you break the cycle. And you can do a lot of like great symbolic kumbaya things. You can build like a national monument to like racial reconciliation. You know, you get a bunch of like black leaders on TV to sign like a declaration of forgiveness, right? You get like Oprah and Kanye West. You know, like there's interesting propaganda things you can do, right?
You know, you have a lot of odd and sometimes, I would say, not the greatest, sometimes, ideas. But one thing I will give you is that they are always interesting. And I will say, if you were Ron DeSantis' campaign manager, comms director, whatever else it would be a very interesting campaign to watch.
Yep.
Well, you admit that he definitely would have gotten a better performance than he did this year.
I don't even think you're wrong on that. I think that it would be very hard to, I mean, because like you said, everyone is so terrified of trying to even be the alpha to Trump, and the conservatives wanted some alpha. They wanted someone to do that. But I will say, running to the right of the other candidates, like DeSantis did try to, you know, so DeSantis did try to do this, oh, I'm the hardline anti-gay, anti-trans candidate, unlike Trump. And that was one of the things that completely blew his campaign out of the water. He was run by all these extremely online sorts who thought that this culture war fodder was what people wanted. So he gave them all this culture war fodder. And it turns out that
to his right, so he lost that. He lost like the all right to Vivek, to the Indian guy, because Vivek was willing to say like fascier things than him, right? Like Vivek when it said the great replacement is real, and like of course all the white nationalists will support Vivek after that instead of this. So DeSantis lost even the far. It was
an embarrassment of a campaign, but also like a campaign that. So anytime you're leaning far to the right like that, you're going to be pretty off-putting, even with some like. You know, throwing bones, throwing transactional things to people, you're going to be pretty off-putting to the center, the squishy center that you may not need them in primaries, but anytime a general election comes around, a great majority, not a great majority, a plurality of people in the country are somewhere in this squishy center, don't really have super strong opinions about a lot of things, but kind of go on vibes and don't like extreme vibes. And you'd be giving off a lot of extreme vibes to
I think they're okay with, because what I find is that most centrists aren't really moderate. Most centrists have like a weird eclectic combination of like far right and far left beliefs. And like I find that like it's all about the Sturm und Drang. You just like Trump won in 2016 because he combined like the extreme like left wing hatred of like NAFTA and outsourcing and the, you know, like the globalists, like the Goldman Sachs people giving Hillary all the money, right? With the extreme right wing hatred of immigrants. Like he mobilized that very well. I mean, a lot of people hated him, you know, in upper middle class suburbs and shit, but like that didn't really matter because he got this coalition of proles. And like, I think
mattered in all the midterms and everything since. Like it wasn't, hasn't been a sustainable strategy. And I would say even with that coalition of proles, it's always risky to overgeneralize from any one election, but both him and Biden, you can make a convincing case that they managed to convince voters during the cycle that they won that they were the more moderate in some ways. Like Trump abandoned some of the standard, like Trump was this, Trump's extreme nature is not in being extremely conservative, it is in being extremely Trump. And so he had these sort of squishy pro-choice-ish stuff in some
ways. Because he's more masculine, and that's the thing, is that like
right so but what I'll say is masculinity is different from positioning as having extreme stances. And I think masculinity, sure, that might appeal to people. Positioning as having extreme stances, that's what scares voters off.
Right, yeah. What I want is Jeb Bush, who acts like hyper Trump. That's my preferred candidate.
Okay, that makes sense.
Like imagine Jeb Bush who talks like Benito Mussolini. Like that's how I think you risk the right politics.
Yeah, you know, I actually do think that would be a very strong Republican candidate.
And I think I can turn DeSantis into that. I have conversations with people who are like powerful in Republican politics. Okay, like I still have friends, like people who watch my videos as teenagers who still talk to me, who like my opinions on stuff, and they could put me in touch with some people. Like that's going to be my goal, is to write enough essays about how like DeSantis could do this. Because I mean, who knows? But if he like doesn't fuck up in Florida over the next few years, he could still have a good national brand. And I like, who's going to inherit the Republican Party after Trump croaks or you know, it, like is term limited? I mean, they're all like maggots. Like they're literally just like cockroaches. Like none of them has the gravitas. Like DeSantis is the only one who even comes close. You know. So,
I mean, my whole theory about that is that it'll just keep diminishing in prestige and being this regional party of grievances and so forth. But if they listen to you on that, then they might be able to maintain electoral power. Still, we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I like how you described, I guess, like the MAGA movement as prioritizing the interests of uneducated and superstitious peasants. I mean, yeah, you're not wrong. That's a good way to put it. And it's hard to, I don't know how you coalesce something
it's,
else.
It's like a, it's like a Republican Party from Latin America. That's the thing. It's like we all thought Hispanics would never vote Republican, but they are, because the Republican Party just became like a party of the caudillos. So it became a party of like the you know, the peasants who were promised by the churches and the caudillo that we're going to crush the like communist intelligentsia in the cities. Right. And that's yeah, I mean, the Republican Party is just a Latin American party. Like, remember that famous song from like 2020 that like vote for Trump, that it was like all the Cubans and like, yeah, like Hispanics love Trump now. And it's the ironic thing, like they're like Hispanics are going to vote, are going to swing massively pro-Republican over the next few decades. And that's another reason I'm not a white nationalist, is because like I view the most anti-white people as like upper middle class white women, mostly in like the Midwest and the Northeast, who just are like ferociously risk averse and ferociously like conformist. And like those are my enemies. If anything, I ally with like the other like young black and Hispanic guys at work who can, you know, who get annoyed when, you know, these women want us to like take notes all the time and shit. Like that those are my natural allies, right? And that's how the Republican Party is going to keep in power. But at the same time, it unleashes a lot of like stupid tendencies that I don't like, because I want a more intellectual, more, I don't know, serious and principled Republican Party. And I think the way you get that is by giving, like, yeah, it's a very explicitly transactional approach to politics, right? Where you know, you go to Iowa and you tell the corn farmers, like, look, like, we'll give you these subsidies, we'll give you all these whatever, but you cannot, like, you have to stop fucking voting for pro-life maximalism. Because this is another argument I made, is that these crazy, like, hysterical pro-life extremists are getting babies killed because they've polarized women into, like, supporting abortion up to the point of birth. Like, this is a recent statistic that came out. Like, the majority of Americans now support abortion to the point of birth, which it's because Republicans overreached radically. They could have just taken, like Roberts wanted to boil the frog, right, and gradually dismantle Roe v. Wade. That was the correct approach. It would have worked. But these morons, they care more about grandstanding than they care about actually saving babies, right? So what do? They want this, like, explicit victory of Roe v. Wade being overturned. Like, that's so retarded. Like, all you're going to do is provoke a massive thermostatic backlash and you know, make people much more pro-choice than they already were, right? Like,
it seems like unique to this particular situation, because the Republicans for like 50 years could just keep complaining about Roe v. Wade and then not have to do anything about it.
Yeah, well, I'll say just with that in general, like, and this is one of the many reasons why I can't really see myself working that explicitly that much with the Republican Party ever, is that, like, that's what Republicans want. Like, they don't want precise, careful policy choices crafted by this group of elites, what have you. They want Sturm und Drang. They want noise. They want people who say, yeah, we want to end all abortions, everything. They want this very hardline feeling.
So the way you do that, here's how you deal with that. Here's how you do that. On one hand, you say that you're going to you force them into a centrist position by doing the Roe v. Wade, you know, like banning it after viability with the exceptions for rape and incest, whatever. But at the same time, you try to get the death penalty to abortionists in the third trimester, and you make that like the big centerpiece of your campaign. And you talk about how you're going to kill the people who are like murdering babies and chopping them up in the womb.
How many third trimester abortions do you think happen?
A lot.
As a proportion of,
there are several hundred.
As a proportion of all abortions. Well, what's your estimate?
I the last I saw that there are a few hundred elective that occur every year, and I would say one is too many. I'd say that's just a monstrous thing to allow to happen. But I'm okay with doing it for like genetic health. I'm okay with doing it for like you know, rape or incest. But if it's literally just an elective abortion done in the third trimester because you were lazy, it's like, no, I'm sorry. Like, you deserve the death penalty. Like that's murder. But I'm okay with abortion in other cases.
Okay, I haven't seen the source for this. I don't know what state would allow.
Colorado.
Yeah. Okay.
No, and I certainly don't go as far as death penalty with that, but I absolutely very fundamentally agree that there are more elective third trimester abortions than people credit, that it is an actual issue, and that that if you want to point to a real definite issue within that.
And for the record, I don't actually support the death penalty either, but it's just a way to tap into
just a rhetorical thing. Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's what gives you space to like move them to the center, you know. And that's how you have to think about things.
And you maybe at the same time, you know, you toss enough extreme rhetoric out there, and you hang yourself on your own. You make your own brand poisonous, and I think it can go very much that direction for a lot of people. Try it. I again, DeSantis. He didn't. he was never trying to gesture towards the center with his policies, but, you know, he was trying to throw a lot of red meat that direction, and he did end up just poisoning his own brand.
The problem is most Republicans have a low verbal IQ, and they don't understand propaganda or art, or they don't understand subtext. They don't understand these things. You know, who I like to look at is Huey Long. You know, he was somebody who knew how to put together like a multiracial coalition under like hard economic times that was able to basically give him like absolute power. And, you know, I look at like how is it that somebody like that, like you don't do it by being moderate, by being inoffensive. You do it by being offensive in a lot of different directions that you know, like builds you like a broad coalition that includes like enough competent people to actually like get things done. But you have to be very calculated. You have to have an extraordinarily high verbal IQ to pull this off. And most.
Yeah. No, I do want to push back on the idea that on this idea of you have to be offensive to not be or you have to be offensive to be firm. I don't really agree with that. I think that someone can absolutely be firmly, emphatically moderate, can take some hardline stances. But I think that you can be hardline, you can be clear, you can be emphatic without being offensive. And I think that there is a tendency to lean into the low and a tendency to lean into ugliness that people do sense. And they pair that with this tendency to be firm, tendency to be stand on principle, so forth. And people like that firmness, they like that standing on principle. And then they see, oh, but this standing on principle drags someone to really low territory. I think there is a balance to be struck. And I think the balance can be struck without saying, oh, yeah, no, you need to be offensive. You need to be offensive many different directions. You can take a lot of really emphatic stances without going out of your way to try to offend people. And I think I do that. I think a lot of people do
it. It doesn't build salience as rapidly. Like if you look at how Trump won the Republican primary, the reason he got so much momentum early on was because he just like clobbered Jeb Bush. And what happened was when you see Trump attacking Jeb Bush, who anyone who hates the Bush family, anyone who's like a protectionist from the Midwest or a libertarian who associates the Bush brand with the kind of neoconservatism that like, you know, fucked the whole country up for like a decade, then like it doesn't matter Trump's position. You're just going to like emotionally support Trump no matter what after that. Right. And that's what.
But that's how you get the superstitious peasants as your base.
Exactly. And that's, I agree. It's a double-sided, it's a double-headed coin. And I don't necessarily know the best way of dealing with it because it's like, on one hand, yeah, I mean, Trump fooled me. He built a coalition of superstitious peasants using people like me as his wedge into the high culture. And I regret it on some level. But I also don't regret it on another level because it's like, it did stop the anti-white problem. So it's like, I have very complicated feelings on it. But I do know in the future, I do agree with you, Trace, that like the extreme offensiveness, I mean, it probably is at Trump's level counterproductive and it leads to a very stupid kind of grifter kind of. But I think there is a calculated way to be offensive that if you offend the right people, it builds up immense emotional support in your in-group that allows you to convince your in-group of things that are, you know, otherwise unpalatable to them for, you know, identitarian reasons.
If you're talking about like the anti-white hatred in sociology classes, I don't know if that's gone away yet.
I think it extremism plays on extremism. Like, so as you're polarizing that, the ones who are leaning into that just polarize even harder in that direction and retrench themselves. It gives them something to rally around and something to rally against. It raises the salience of your enemies the same way it raises the salience of your allies.
Yeah, it's always a case-by-case thing on whether it's worth it. And I think that like with Trump, it was the first time it had been tried like this in a way. Like there wasn't enough calculation, but at the same time, in the national climate, there probably couldn't have been. And it was too untested. I don't know. I mean, I think that all I'll say is that I'll be much more calculating about it. If I ever get any sort of like leadership role in politics or whatever, I'm going to be much more calculating about it than say Steve Bannon was. I think that he like unleashed a lot of forces that, you know, a kulak revolution, as he said, that like just wasn't, it didn't play out the way he expected or the way Richard Spencer expected or the way any of us really wanted.
Well, he's still making money, so.
Yeah,
well, that's the problem. It was a principal agent problem, yeah.
It's hard for anything like that to play out the way the one who wants it to play out will. There are fewer puppet masters and more wave riders, I think, than some of us who like all our ideas like to imagine at times.
I think you're
anyway,
right.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to leave as well.
Okay.
All right. But I'm happy to come on your podcast and talk about anything else. I'll send you the raw recording from all this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this will be a great discussion to I think people are going to be really interested in this. I think this was a great talk.
Yeah, I appreciate you being able to be willing to be subjected to some criticism and being able to mix it up too.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love it. This is what I live for. You know, not being a public figure for 8 years was hell for me, because it's like being able to talk to highest quality people and like really get my beliefs challenged in a meaningful way is like, just, it's something you can't have in like normie life. It's just like,
I know very well how freeing that is.
All right. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Walt.
Yeah. Thank you so much, man. Have a good one. Take care.
All right. You too.
See you guys.
See ya.